Okay, it looks like we are ready to go here. So welcome everyone to the June 7th meeting, SLOCOG board meeting, and we are going to first rise for a flag salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Very good. So we'll officially call this meeting to order. Did I start too fast? Or are you ready for a roll call?
Board Member Gibson.
Here.
Board Member Guthrie.
Here.
Board Member Moreno.
Here.
Board Member Ortiz Legg.
Here.
Board Member Paulding.
Here.
Board Member Pichon. Board Member Rushing.
Here.
Board Member Strong. Board Member Waggy.
Here.
Board Member Wixom. Vice President Pease.
Here.
President Arnold.
I'm here.
Scott Eads, Caltrans District 5.
Present.
Supervisor
Pichon just arrived.
Board Member Pichon.
Yes, here.
All righty. We've got it all, right, Ida? Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move on to public comment. And I'll just remind folks, when you come to the podium, just be sure to state your name for the record, and then we'll go from there. So public comment, this is for items not on the agenda, and I have one request to speak. If anyone else would like to speak, grab a yellow slip from the back and let us know. Eric Greening.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Eric Greening. And since there is not likely to be an RTA board meeting for several months, I'm going to take the liberty of making a comment that has in some ways more to do with the RTA than with SLOCOG. But of course, SLOCOG oversees transportation, and this has ramifications for SLOCOG and a lot of other policy making bodies as well. Last Thursday, the grade was completely tied up for hours on end, northbound, relatively unaffected southbound. And what I would welcome would be an agenda item for the RTA that would review what are our options during such time. And we have wonderful dispatchers who I always trust to make the right decisions. Do they have, what latitude do they have right now on a policy basis? Does that latitude need to change? With the driving public, people who wanted to get north from San Luis Obispo were frustrated in that for hours on end. People headed south were relatively unaffected. Transit users were differently affected because the buses that would have taken them south were prevented from going north. So for a time, service was seriously disrupted in both directions. Would it have made sense for a Route 9 bus or two during that time to have taken an alternate route, perhaps Morro Bay Highway 41, if a southbound would be available at the Atascadero Transit Center, then they could continue the route from there and the people could transfer. If not, perhaps they'd take the 101 to Santa Margarita and back north to cover all stops. In any event, are those options now available at the discretion of the dispatcher based on the decision available? Sometimes that would be a bad decision. 41 might have gotten just as blocked as 101. But again, and this would be looking both at this incident, but also at other incidents and possible incidents. I just think we should be clear on a policy level. What latitude does dispatchers have? What information flow on traffic in general do they have access to? And in general, I trust them to make the right decisions, but are their hands tied on a policy level, and to what extent should they be tied or untied? Anyway, thank you very much. And from now on, I'll be commenting on slow cog issues. Thank you.
No, we're glad to hear about that, Eric. And I was one that tested the 41, and that didn't work either, so FYI. Okie doke. We'll move on to our director's report, and we'll start with Pete.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I just have a couple of items here to review what we've been doing over the past couple of months. Gus Curry really pulled off this May 5th visit, where we showcased sort of the 101 Pismo Beach project with Senator Laird, Assemblywoman Addis. We had the chair of the CTC. We had Tony Tavares, the Caltrans director, as well as city council members. Mr. Waghi was there. We had Councilwoman Reese. And really, it's to raise awareness about our, two key projects in the region: the Left Shoulder Managed Lane project, which we're anxiously awaiting to hear from the California Transportation Commission whether we'll receive about $60 million in discretionary funding. And then in North County, on the Union Road overpass project, and here you see Tony speaking to the group at a winery up there in Paso Robles. They're seeking trade corridor funding for the ad-grade separation. And then another big event hosted by Scott Eads, my buddy right here, on April 25th, the groundbreaking for the Y project. This is probably the most significant transportation project in the county since the Cuesta Grade in the mid-1990s, which was only a $50 million project, believe it or not. So this project, hopefully, I think we're still on track for 2026 completion. Maybe it'll be late 2026. Unfortunately, there was just recently another fatality out there at the Y. And how's it going to look when you're going, to the right here is obviously Bakersfield, and to the north, to the top would be Fresno. You'll have two lanes veering off to the right to do a flyover that will bring you to Highway 41, which is sort of the dominant move, I think, with traffic volumes. And then you can sort of see the alignment. The existing intersection is in the red X on the bottom here. It was a busy month last month with Bike to School Day. We had we have several rideshare staff out there that worked hard on this. The way this works is it's really community-focused and self-focused by businesses and coffee shops and bike shops that are able to receive reimbursement grants of about $200 for pancakes or strawberries or coffee, and it brings out the people. This is a crew out in Los Osos biking to school, and we were flipping pancakes. We have Ashley and Ritu and Mallory and our staff in the photo. There was also an event in Oceano. This was May 23rd. Supervisor Paulding was there. We had the Active Transportation Resource Center that helped the Oceano area sort of focus on what improvements would be helpful. You can see John Wallow's, not John Wallow, John Waddell is in the photo there. They actually walked the area around the school, and as well as Supervisor Paulding, looking at potential projects. And so there'll be some surveying that's done in this area as we work towards the Safe Routes for All project that we'll be working on over the next year. And then we also had the North County Corridor Mobility Master Plan. And these are the kinds of corridor studies that are needed to attract the discretionary state resources. In the bottom left corner, you can see the work being done on the off-ramp on Highway 101 to 46, and there's the Union Road project as well. The scope of this project goes all the way down to Highway 58 near Santa Margarita, and all the way up out to Jardine Road out on Highway 46. We're also still working on broadband issues. the next roundtable, regional roundtable, is June 21st. We have people in person, you know, pulling together North County and South County and seeing what everybody's doing on broadband and how we can make sure we're all connected. This time we're going to have Caltrans talk about what they're doing on Highway 101 and all of their projects. And the good news is, hey, we won an award for the transportation efficiency analysis through NARC. Fred is in the photo there in the bottom right. He accepted the award in Detroit. I just got back from Detroit with Fred. It's really a rockin' city. Believe it or not, its reputation does not do it any favors, but it's really a comeback city. The Motor City has a lot going on for it. But as you'll recall, the transportation efficiency analysis is basically a geospatial tool that allows us to prioritize pro-housing transportation projects to have those be able to float to the top so we can push towards more housing availability in the county. A couple of rail updates. We were able to affect the state rail plan by recommending that the plan not advance the Coast Train to be implemented by 2027. We had the San Clemente slide that, you know, provides through service to San Diego. Unfortunately, 2 days ago, I heard it was just closed again with some problems on the alignment. And then getting towards the end here, we have a couple new staff members I'd like to stand up, Annie and Paige. They both sort of have origin in the Pacific Northwest. Paige there obviously is on your left. She comes to us via the Pacific Northwest, but via Berkeley. And Paige will be working on the Know How to Go program. And Annie on the right will be the public information officer for the agency, most recently from Paso Robles, but not a Bearcat. And then on consent, we have a couple of notable items. The Transportation Deficiency Act allocations, you know, this is about $19 million that we distribute to the region. So that's on consent. We have a grant camp coming up for your staff, for local agency staff. We're still pulling that together, getting special speakers. There's so much opportunity with the new discretionary grant programs out there. Some of the notice of funding availabilities are not even out yet for the new grant programs. There's an update on the fund cycle and approval of the programming policies in your consent agenda. And then we have the state and federal advocacy contracts. I don't see Gus in the room, but he'll be here later. And then I also want to recognize Will Daniels, if you could stand up in the back. Will was a student intern of ours. He worked on an ATP project ranking methodology, and that's on the consent agenda, too. Thank you for your work, Will, over the last couple of months, 9 months. With that, I would open it up. I will finally say that there was some talk of some rescissions and clawback on transportation dollars with the debt ceiling negotiations and the deal. We believe we're not losing any funding to our region through that clawback of the what we call the CARISA, Corona Virus Relief Recovery Act, something like that. Is that correct? Is it statewide we're not losing any funding?
I'm not sure about statewide.
But our county's not losing any. With that, I'll see if there's any questions.
That's lucky. Questions to my right? Comments? Anyone? To my left? You guys are all quiet today. I just want to say, whoever took that picture of Pete flipping the pancakes where the pancake was up in the air, that was a really great picture. I wonder if you caught it or if it landed on the ground up after the photo.
Sarah took that picture. I don't see her out there. Oh, there she is.
Oh, there she is. That was really a great picture. I was also going to say, Fred's not here, so I could tell him this, but that slide for the surf liner going down to San Diego, what a coincidence, but I was scheduled, my husband had a cattle feeder meeting with the Arizona cattle feeders and the California cattle feeders in San Diego on May 23rd. So I had our tickets. We loved to take the train. Picnic was packed. Everything's ready to leave out of San Luis at 6:11, right? And we wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and get the Amtrak text. Call Amtrak. We have some news about your upcoming trip. And it was canceled because right then, that night or in the night or whenever that slide happened. So we were just staring at each other like, shoot. So we packed the car and drive to San Diego. It just made me really appreciate the train more than ever, because coming back on the Friday before Memorial Day weekend was not good coming through Southern California. Kept thinking, how come the slide not now? But anyway, we got to really compare because our mind was on it. We could have been on the train enjoying ourselves coming home. And
Do have motor coach options to
motor
coach you around. But
and they try so hard, but we had a hard time to be there, and the train was going to work, but not all the rest of it. So anyway, I hope they get it fixed, and I'll always remember my mind was on the difference of how much more fun it is to take the train and drive through Southern California traffic on a holiday weekend. So anyway, thanks, Pete. No more questions. Don?
I just want to congratulate you and your team for getting awarded in Detroit. I mean, you're there at the National, and I don't know if you wanted to say a couple words about the spatial, what you got your award for.
Yeah, you know, it is really an innovative study. I believe Santa Barbara is beginning to undertake a similar transportation efficiency analysis type. Sarah, do you want to speak about... Sarah and Ritu are here, which were the primary brains behind the report. And this is being recognized nationally because for the small metropolitan areas, nobody's doing this. And so people are calling us, asking us how we did it. And we have great technical staff and policy staff. So thanks for your hard work, Sarah. And Ritu.
Okay, last call, anybody? Okay. Scott, you're up. Thank you for being here.
All right. Good morning, Chair Arnold and members of the board. Scott Eads, District Director for District 5. Happy to be here with you this morning. Have a few things. First, I just wanted to also make note of some of the things that Pete did. The groundbreaking event at the Y was really exciting to be there. And it was really great for us to also have our director of all of Caltrans be present as well. So that was pretty exciting. He was actually in town twice, and the other was for the other event that Pete mentioned on the project tour for the Five Cities Multimodal Project, as well as the Airport Road, Union Road project up in Paso. So he attended both, which was great for us, great exposure for the project and for the others that attended. Both of those are seeking funding, so having additional thoughts on those projects and awareness of those projects is a good thing. All right, so another news, wanted to highlight that the Toro Creek Bridge is now open in the northbound direction, just north of Morro Bay. So great project. We were able to widen the shoulder. Construction began about a year ago. And we're now continuing work on the southbound direction. The project was a total of $17.9 million, almost 18, and 16.3 of that was SB1, Senate Bill 1 funds. And then just also want to highlight, we received positive feedback from a community member, Leah Brooks, who sent us an email saying that the wider shoulder is fabulous for bikes. And she has been riding her bicycle since 1973. So congratulations to Leah for 50 years of riding that section, and we appreciate the feedback. All right. Going further north on Highway 1, we just were able to open right before Memorial Day weekend. 21 additional miles of the Big Sur Coast has been open. Now it's all open all the way to just south of Limekiln State Park. The park is not open, so don't try to make it to the park. You're not going to be able to get there, or they won't welcome you when you get there. There's a turnaround just before that. The big impediment that's just beyond that is Paul's slide. So that slide is massive. We're working to remove about 500,000 cubic yards of material. It's just ginormous, and it's so we'll be working on that for a while. We're working 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, and we expect the full closure at this location will continue for several months. and we expect a more refined estimate for when we'll be able to reopen that location in early July. And then just the last thing I want to highlight is the AIDS Life bicycle ride is heading south. So it began on June 4th, and today it's leaving Paso Robles, so it'll be passing through the area. So it's taking Highway 46 west to Highway 1 through Cayucas and Morro Bay, and it'll end up in Santa Maria today, I believe, and then tomorrow it'll head down to Lompoc. That's all I have. Happy to take any questions.
Questions for Scott? Comments for Scott? That means you're doing a really good job, Scott. Nobody wants to say anything cranky about anything. That's good.
I'll take that.
Okay. Thank you very much to you both for your reports. And at this time, then, we're going to move on to, out public. I don't see any public speaking on any of this. No one requesting to speak from public. Okay, we're going to move on to consent agenda. And we'll go to public comments on the consent agenda. I have one request to speak. Eric, thank you.
Thank you. Eric Greening on C3. First, it is simply a wonderful idea to tap the knowledgeable creativity of students. And number two, I would encourage you not just to read the little staff report, but to actually read the report that was done by Will Daniels in terms of providing a sound methodology for weighing the various factors on active transportation projects from safety to connectivity and so on. I think overall, it is a very fine, solid piece of work. If there's a nuance I would like to introduce, it's simply in relation to safety, maybe there could be a little more recognition of the distinction between class one and class two facilities. I know some class two facilities ranked very high in this, and obviously when you can't get class one, class two is necessary. But I think where class one can be achieved, it is definitely the soundest. Obviously, the actual prioritization and programming under current circumstances often depends on how long a project has been on the queue or whether it meets the criteria of some form of grant that we might be hoping to get. If approval of a revenue measure transforms SLOCOG from a largely begging agency to a more solidly programming agency, I would very strongly recommend that this tool be, if not simply flat out used, at least incorporated into the matrix of how the decisions and priorities are made going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. And any other requests to speak? This would be for items A1 through E1 on the agenda. Don't see any other requests to speak. I'll bring it back to the board and ask if any of the board members have questions or comments on A1 through E1. Looking down. Yes, Jimmy.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a correction to make to the meeting notes or the meeting minutes there. I guess, let's see, it is page. Now I've lost my document. A111. Where it states, this was a comment that I made, it says, a study shows that 50% of students in this county is a minority. We want to change that to studies have shown that over 50% of the students in Oceano walk or bike to school. That's more consistent with what I stated. So if we could just modify the meeting minutes accordingly, I'd appreciate it.
Chair, I have a brief change as well.
Thank you, Heather.
Also on the, so A112 on the minutes, the F4 broadband update, it's simply removing one word, which is will. So board member Heather Moreno asked if most of the households included in the 20% who are eligible for reduced funding have access, not will have access. It's do they have access. So remove the word will. Thank you.
Okay. Did we get all that? Okay. Any other questions or comments on the consent? And if not, I would entertain a motion to approve.
Chair, I'll move approval with the two changes that were specified to item A1.
And I'll second.
Okay. Got a motion, Jimmy. A second is Heather. And we'll have a roll call vote whenever you're ready.
Board Member Paulding?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
Yes.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Ortiz Legg?
Yes.
Board Member Bichon?
Yes.
Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Waggy?
Yes.
Board Member Wixom?
Yes.
Vice President Pease?
Yes.
President Arnold?
Yes.
The motion carried.
Great. Thank you. So we're going to move on now to F1 on our first, excuse me, I'm taking all that back. We're going to move down to our public hearing portion of our agenda, and I'm using the chair's prerogative at the request of some of the board members to move directly to F4, and then we'll go back to F1. So let's see. That means that James is on deck. F4 on our agenda, just to clarify it for everyone.
Thank you, Board, and good morning. James Worth, Lee Slocog staff. So this item has three parts to it: polling results, next steps, and more information. I want to jump right over to our consultant, Tim McLarney from True North Research, and introduce him to give the results of the poll that he did this past spring. Tim, you can take it away.
Great. Thank you, James. Good morning, Madam President, members of the board. I'm Dr. Tim McLarney. I'm the president of True North Research. We are a firm that over the last 20 years has specialized in working with public agencies in using surveys to develop a statistically reliable understanding of the communities and the customers that they serve. To date, we've worked on over 1,200 research studies for public agencies, and about half of the work that we're doing these days is what's called revenue measure feasibility studies, like what we're going to be talking about today, where the goal is to understand if it's feasible for an agency to move forward with some type of revenue measure, and if it is feasible, to help them determine how they might go about structuring that measure in a way that it's consistent with the type of measure that their community is interested in supporting. Today's presentation just covers the highlights of this report that is out, and as I go through the presentation or at the end, whichever is your preference, I welcome questions along the way. So with that, let me jump in here. Okay, so before we talk about the actual results, help them take a quick moment to review the purpose of the study as well as the methodology. So in terms of the purpose of the study, as I mentioned earlier, it's a revenue measure feasibility study. It's basically designed to address those three bullets that you see there on that slide. The first is to answer that basic question, is a local transportation sales tax measure for a place on the ballot in 2024, does it have a reasonable chance of success? Answer that question isn't always yes. Sometimes we do this type of work, and no matter how you look at the data, there's really not a clear path to get you from where you are today to where you need to be to have a reasonable chance of success on election day. And if that's the case, I'll be the first person to tell you that. Where we do see feasibility, that second question or bullet sort of kicks in gear, is to understand how might you structure a measure in a way that it's consistent with the type of measure that your community would be interested in supporting. There's a lot of components to a revenue measure package. There's the expenditure plan. You know, if it were successful, how would you plan to spend the money? There's the tax rate that's associated with it. There's questions about the duration. When's the optimum time to place it on the ballot? What types of accountability provisions might be built into this measure? And so all of those types of items that you would ultimately, questions that you'd ultimately need to answer before placing a measure on the ballot, the survey can help guide. And then thirdly, it's an important opportunity in the survey to understand the role of information and communication in ultimately sort of shaping your voters' perspectives on this proposal. I'm a big proponent that if a public agency is going to take the step of placing a revenue measure on the ballot and asking voters to make a decision, it's really incumbent upon that agency to educate voters about the decision you're asking them to make. You're not advocating up or down as the public agency for a particular revenue measure with public dollars. That's not what you're doing, but you're just giving them the basic information that they need to make a well-informed decision. So in terms of the methodology, when you're doing revenue measure research, the first thing you want to think about is, you know, who are the individuals who are ultimately going to be deciding this measure if you were to place it on the ballot? And then you want to create a random sample of those individuals. In this case, we were looking at two election environments in 2024. One would be the presidential general election in November of 2024. Nested within that electorate, which is a very large electorate, is a group of voters who are also likely to participate in the March 2024 election. So you have the sample that sort of looks like layers in an onion. The entire onion would be the November 2024 electorate. Nested within there is a smaller group of voters who are likely to participate in March. We use what's called stratified and clustered random sampling to choose a sample from those two universes that is ultimately representative on all of the variables that we know are related to how voters tend to vote on these measures. So things like age and gender, of course, but partisanship as well as household party type. That latter one is actually the most predictive single variable in terms of how people tend to vote on revenue measures, is not just understanding what that individual's partisanship is, but what's the partisanship of the people that they live in or live with, because it's that household dynamic that tends to ultimately shape political behavior more than anything else. Once we have selected our sample, we recruited using three different methods. We reached out by email, text, and telephone. All of the hyperlinks in the email and text invitations were PIN protected so that when we sent it to a particular individual, that person clicked on it. We knew it was on the other end of that. It's secure so that only those individuals who receive invitations can access the site. Once the survey was taken, they can't retake it a bunch of times or send that invitation off to their friends. So it's very secure. Individuals have the option of participating by telephone or online, as well as in English and Spanish. And ultimately, we wound up completing 1,095 interviews. And because that is a random sample of 1,095 and not a census of all your likely November voters, it has what's known as a margin of error due to sampling. In this case, that is plus or minus 3%. What that means is we can be 95% confident that the results I'll share with you today are within 3% of what we would have found had we spoken with all of your likely voters. Okay, so on to the results. This first slide shows the results of what we call our importance of issues question. And for each of the issues on that slide, we simply ask voters to tell us how important this is to them. Is it extremely important or very important, somewhat important, or not at all important? These are asked in a random order, but we've sorted them from high to low here based on that combined percentage of folks who said it's either extremely or very important. At the top, we asked this question for a couple of reasons. One, it's just a nice warm-up question, kind of gets voters into the groove of taking the survey. But it's also an opportunity for us to understand how items that would be impacted by your proposed sales tax measures, so things like maintaining local infrastructure and improving the maintenance of streets and roads, how those issues stack up against other issues that also compete for tax dollars, and importantly, how those issues stack up against the issue of preventing local tax increases. Kind of a rough rule of thumb, but it makes a lot of sense that the more importance that voters place on the issues that would be funded by your measure relative to the issue of preventing local tax increases, the better positioned you are to move forward with some type of revenue measure for those items. And what you see here at the top of the list, addressing homelessness, that was the number one issue in the county at 81%. Then followed by maintaining local infrastructure at 78% and improving the maintenance of streets and roads at 76% on down. As you get to the bottom, you see second up from the above is preventing local tax increases at 59%. So you've got about a 20-point gap in the perceived importance of some of your transportation-related items towards the top and that issue of preventing local tax increases. That's a good size gap. The other thing I would point out that is different about SLO, you know, we've done this for other counties, particularly a lot of Southern California counties, and what you find is reducing traffic congestion in terms of perceived importance comes into the bottom of the list. Most of the time in a lot of the counties where that have these transportation-related sales taxes, the issue of reducing traffic congestion can be a real driver in terms of motivating voters to support these types of measures. Not as much as a driver in SLO. It's more, as you can see here, and you'll see in a couple other slides, it's more about repairing and maintenance and maintaining your existing infrastructure. So after that slide, we get to what we call an initial ballot test. And the idea is, before we get any deeper into this interview and we start talking in more detail about how the money could be spent, arguments pro and con related to this proposal, we want to present to voters a mock-up of what we think that 75-word ballot statement could look like. It's a really good gauge of where your voters are at on the natural with respect to the proposal. So shown here is the 75-word statement that we tested, and here are the results. At that initial ballot test, you had 59% of likely voters say that they would support this proposal. You had about a third say they would oppose. You had about 7% who were unsure. So this is about 8 points shy of the two-thirds threshold required for passage. One of the interesting things about the results in this poll is that shown here are the likely November 2024 results. When you subset down to the likely March universe, in most communities, that universe is older, more likely to be a homeowner, more conservative, tends to be less tax friendly than the larger November universe. But in SLO, that doesn't really pan out. In fact, the March results in this poll are very similar to the November results as you go through at each of the ballot tests. So they're within 2 points of what we're finding in November, which is unusual, and it actually creates some opportunities that normally aren't there when it comes to some of these types of resume measures, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end. Okay, this, by the way, is how the initial ballot test results break out by the four main subregions within the study. You can see that there's majority support for this proposal in all four subregions, and in the North Coast region, it comes in just shy of two-thirds at that initial ballot test. So after the initial ballot test, we move on to what we call the projects and services section, and here's where we're trying to do two things with this respondent. One, we're now going to start to educate them more about what this measure would accomplish. Up to this point, they've only had that 75-word ballot statement. We can only say so much in 75 words about how the money would be used. Here in this section, we get to unpack it into a series of discrete uses for the funds. And in that way, we're giving respondents a better idea about what this measure would accomplish. The other thing it allows us to do is to understand of all the ways that you could theoretically spend the revenues, which of these ultimately rises to the top of the list in terms of voters' priorities. And I've broken them into two tiers here, just based on there's a lot of projects we tested, and it would be very difficult to read if I put them all on one screen, so I've just broken them in half. And here you see tier one. And what sort of jumps out from the tier one results here is, you know, there's a lot of emphasis, again, on basic repair and maintenance of your infrastructure. So the top item there, fixing potholes and then paving and maintaining local streets and roads, retrofitting or replacing older bridges and overpasses that have structural problems. So here again, we're seeing that voters are keying in on, you know, the need to repair and maintain your existing system. Here is tier two. You can see that, you know, everything we tested had at least 50% of voters say that they would favor spending some of the money on those items. But like what we see in a lot of counties, when you get to sort of transit-related improvements or active transportation, you tend to see some fall off in terms of support for those things because not everybody's, you know, personally invested in using transit or in active transportation. And so you tend to see that those items test a little more towards the bottom of the pile here. Now, if the board were to choose to place a measure on the ballot, there's going to be an election cycle. And during that election cycle, you're going to have a lot of discussion and debate in the county about this proposal. There will be some folks who will step up and advocate on behalf of this measure, argue to their friends and neighbors about why it's needed and why they should vote yes. You might also have opponents who step up and say it's a bad idea, you shouldn't be doing this, and here's why. For this study to be a reliable gauge of the feasibility of a potential sales tax revenue measure, we need to understand not only where voters are at on the NAFTA, which was that initial ballot test, but what happens once they have more information and exposed to that positive discussion and debate, as well as what happens should you get some active organized opposition. And so we do that by simulating that discussion in the space of the poll and conveying both positive and negative arguments. Here you see the positive arguments that we tested with voters. And at the top of the list in terms of the most convincing or compelling, what we find with your voters interesting is specificity helps. That's not always the case when we do these types of studies. Sometimes the more general, generic arguments tend to test the best. But with your voters, being specific about some of the infrastructure needs that you have tends to help quite a bit. And so the number one item there, for example, at the top of the list, was an argument that most of the bridges and infrastructure in SLO were built more than 70 years ago. They don't meet modern building or safety codes, and many need structural repairs. The longer we wait to fix them, the more expensive they will be. And the second item there talks about the fact that there's over 2,000 miles of streets and roads throughout the county, many of which are overdue for repairs and repaving. And this measure is going to provide the funding needed to keep the streets and roads in good condition. So being able to be specific about numbers of roads, miles of roads, as well as age of infrastructure seems to resonate with your voters. So now at this point in the poll, voters have heard more about this proposal than they did at that initial ballot test. We got to talk more about the projects and service that would be funded. We got to convey positive arguments. So we circle back with what we call our interim ballot test, where we can present to them that same 75-word ballot statement. And we say, now that you've heard a bit more, where do you stand? And you can see that support has now bumped up to 63% of likely voters saying yes. You've got about 31% opposed and another 6% or so who are not sure or prefer not to answer. So at 63%, we're now within sort of stone's throw of that two-thirds that is required for passage. And then we get to the negatives. And the idea behind the negatives is I'm going to put my opponent hat on, and I'm going to convey negative arguments. I'm going to pepper this respondent with a series of negative arguments with the idea that I want to pressure test their support for this proposal. How resilient is support for the measure should you get organized opposition that does a good job of getting their message out there as well? And you can see that we test a bit of a shorter list of negatives than we do positives. That's by design. We tend to find in revenue measure studies that revenue measure campaigns that the proponents tend to be larger in number, better organized, they raise money, they have a louder voice than the opposition. And so we simulate that disparity in the space of the poll by testing fewer negatives. That said, the negatives that we're testing are designed to be hard-hitting negative arguments, right? We're trying to inflict maximum damage here. And so at the top of the list, you can see some of the negatives that are resonating the best right now really have to do with sort of cost of living and also, the sign of the times here. So the top one being about that, slow is an expensive place to live already, and that passing a sales tax is just going to make it less affordable. And the number two negative argument there, just referencing that now is not a good time, right? We just came out of the pandemic. We've got inflation. We got high gas prices. Now it's just not a good time to be raising taxes. So we pepper them with these negatives, and then the question is what happens afterwards, and that's what you see here. The final ballot test, the negatives that you might expect cool us down, they drop us about 7 points, and we land at 57. That's about 10 points below that two-thirds threshold that's required for passage. Here again, what's interesting is your March universe is the exact same number at 57%. Again, most of the time in most counties and most communities, when you go to that smaller universe of voters, you could expect to have anywhere from 5 to sometimes even a 10-point reduction in support among those high propensity voters. We don't see that in SLO or in this data. Okay, so what does all this mean? So I'm going to circle back to that first overarching question that I mentioned at the outset about that motivates this research, which is, if you as a board were to choose this measure or choose to place a measure on the ballot in 2024, does it have a reasonable chance of success? The answer to that is really a qualified yes, right? I see a path here, but it's going to require the right circumstances to be able to hit two-thirds. So why do I say that? There are some clear positive signs in the data that indicate that a measure could be feasible. We saw that, voters rated transportation-related improvements, particularly streets, bridges, and infrastructure, as being among the most important issues facing the county. We had solid natural support for a tax measure, 59%. There's not many measures that I've worked on in my career where right out of the gates you've got two-thirds. It's often, especially when they're countywide measures, it's often the case that you have to sort of build up to that through education and outreach. The projects and improvements that you intend to fund with this measure, should it be successful, were popular. We saw that a lot of the positive arguments resonated, and support increases to 63% at that interim ballot test once they've heard more about what this proposal would accomplish and were exposed to positive arguments. So those are all positive signs that suggest, okay, in the right circumstances, this measure could have a reasonable chance of passage. That said, we also see some things in the data that are challenging, both in the data from the survey as well as sort of stepping back from the survey and thinking about what 2024 is going to look like. This measure requires two-thirds supermajority support, and I can tell you over 20 years I've worked on a lot of these types of measures, they are always nail-biters, right? It's always difficult to get two-thirds of a community's support any proposal, and so hitting that supermajority is just a built-in challenge that, you know, makes this a more difficult exercise than, say, a school bond or a general tax. We do see some sensitivity to the negative arguments within this poll, right? They cooled us down about 7 points from that interim ballot test, so we need to sort of keep that in mind. The third set of challenges are really the unknowns, right? We're here today in 2023. We're talking about an election in 2024. What's going to be the trajectory on inflation, on the economy? You know, the pandemic, we seem to be in a good place with that right now, but I think we've all been sort of tuned up to expect the other shoe to drop at some point. And so we don't know is the point. And so anytime you're thinking about putting a measure on the ballot, you need to sort of be aware that, all right, you know, we want to try and build in a little buffer just in case the weather isn't as good in 2024 as it happens to be right now, let's say. And then finally is the electoral climate. Thinking a little bit, the one sort of sure thing we can expect is 2024 is going to be, you know, like I think some of our more recent elections, there's a hyper-partisanship, right? There's going to be a lot of partisan messaging on both sides that tends to create a little bit of a divide in the electorate. And, you know, revenue measures about bringing people together. And there's also some other initiatives, particularly in November, that could create a bit of a crosswind for other local measures that are on the ballot. And so with that last slide, I've got a couple observations and recommendations. The first thing I want to note is, though, that, you know, it's important to keep in mind that a survey like this is a snapshot in time. It's not a crystal ball looking forward to Election Day saying, you know, you're going to get X percent on Election Day. What happens on Election Day isn't dictated by what your poll says today. It's shaped by everything that happens from this point forward. And it's a reminder that anytime you're doing a revenue measure, you need to be making smart decisions about how you structure that measure in a way that it's consistent with the type of measure your community is interested in supporting. And you got to put the work in. And by that, I mean you need to educate your voters about the decision you're asking them to make. And so under the smart decisions category, I really think that if it's feasible, you would want to keep both March 24 and November 2024 as options. Again, there are some things about March that make it a more attractive option in theory than November. And the problem is it's got a much more aggressive timeline, right? The filing deadline for that election is early December. But again, because your natural level support in that election, which will be a smaller, less noisy affair than the November election, it has some built-in advantages. So ideally, you'd want to keep both of those as options at this point. Proceed with the idea that you were going to go in March, you can always fall back to November. But if you proceed with the idea of going in November, you can never sort of fast forward and be ready to go in March. In terms of project priorities, as I mentioned, there's a lot of emphasis on your voters in sort of repairing and maintaining your existing infrastructure. That seems to be the real hook for this measure for your voters, which is, again, different than what we see in some other counties. And so the items that you see there were kind of the main centerpieces, so to speak, of what your expenditure plan could be built so that it sort of maximizes the, you know, voters' interest. And then finally, the last two items have to do with sort of starting the conversation with the community in a real way about this proposal, right? Up until this point, it's really been doing the research to sort of see where you are now. At this point, if you want to, you know, keep the path open to the idea of possibly putting a measure on the 2024 ballot, it's really time to start, you know, having those conversations with key stakeholders, expanding voter awareness about your needs, and starting to build consensus around an expenditure plan and a proposal. So with that, I end my presentation. I welcome any questions from the board if there are any. And actually, I'm going to hand it back to Jean.
Okay. Questions? Are these questions for Tim? Or are they for you, James? Or
do you want to do questions for Tim first? I do have a couple more
yes.
slides.
He disappeared, sure. And I didn't know if he was still with us, but he's somewhere in there. Cyberland. Thank you. Thank you, Tim, for the presentation, and we'll check in on questions here. I'm looking to my right. No? To my left?
Sorry.
To my... Oh, sorry about that, Jim.
I just
didn't
wondered
see that
in
night.
Your point if you did any polling on a sunset clause, because I know that was important in the last one.
Sunset.
Did you hear that,
we
Tim?
We did build it. I did.
Okay.
We have a 20-year sunset that was built into this proposal. We did not test different sunsets. I tend to find when we do this work that sunsets are a little tricky. Most voters, when they look at a revenue measure, they make their decision based on a couple items. Number one, how much is it going to cost me? Number two, what is it going to fund? The duration of a measure is this distant third item that on the natural voters don't pay much attention to. And we know this because we've done split sample research back for transportation-related projects where we've tested everything from a 10-year to a 40-year sunset, and you basically get the same answer. Where sunset comes into play is more during the campaign. And the longer you make those durations, sometimes if you were to get opposition, they're going to key in on that, and they're going to create sort of artificial level of importance around that sunset with voters. And so it's always a little tricky to figure those things out. 20 years is a pretty safe number because a lot of these, when you look at these transportation measures, because you know, these are big capital intense projects, and you know, when you put smaller sunsets on them, you tend to have a difficult time sort of bonding against that revenue stream and getting the work done that you need to get done. And so we have stuck with a 20-year horizon, which seems to is pretty typical.
Don, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. I'm wondering if you were able to position the question about additional items on the ballot that would also be revenue seeking, meaning competing revenue initiatives. I would imagine that would be very hard to pull on.
Yeah, it usually, because this was the baseline survey, our focus tends to be, let's look at how voters view your measure in a bit of a vacuum, right? So by itself, kind of how they feel about it. As you move forward with these types of measures, at some point, there's a tracking survey. At the point that you do the tracking survey, you'll have a better idea about what other measures are actually going to be sharing the ballot with you in all likelihood. And that's where we build in to our studies using a split sample approach, an experiment where we'll expose half the voters to what other types of measures are going to be sharing the ballot with them, and then get to the transportation sales tax measure. Half the voters won't receive those questions, and that tells you by looking at and comparing those two different subsamples, it tells you how they, you know, how much that sort of other measures on the ballot that are sharing that same ballot with them impact how people view your proposal. Again, because we're so far back from a potential 2024 measure at this point, we didn't want to build that into this particular poll because we don't know what we're going to be sharing the ballot with.
Thank you, Doctor.
I don't see any other lights on. Any other questions? Jimmy?
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate the presentation. Just a question around whether we polled how low are regional sales taxes in relation to surrounding counties and whether that polls well, given the fact that we're on the low side.
We did not. And I have asked those questions in other types of measures, and it winds up voters don't care that much. Right. That, you know, don't tell me what my neighbors are doing. You know, tell me why this here is important for us here in SLO. And so I didn't build that into here because, again, and when I've used it in the past, it's just never been a real driver. The things that tend to be more drivers on this topic are, you know, the idea of matching funds. Right. There's obviously a lot of potential matching funds from the feds that are out there in the state and making sure that you get your fair share of that. That can be important. The other argument I've actually seen test well is the idea that, you know, by passing this measure, you see this a lot in counties like LA where they're up against the cap, where passing this measure is going to ensure now and in the future that a higher percentage of our sales tax dollars, you know, stay local to make improvements here in this particular community or this particular region. You know, for communities that aren't up against the cap, it tends not to be as compelling.
My second question just pertains to next steps, but I think you were planning on covering that, James. So thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Tim. We're James.
Okay. So page F42, Tim, local Tim, can you get my screen up there? Great. Shows this slide, but it shows the highest support percentage of past SLOCOG polls across the board. I indicate that the half-cent 25-year following engagement in 2016 that we did came out at 63% following engagement again. And that's what led into Measure J being put on the ballot for the voters to decide and resulting in an actual final result of 66.3%. Here we are, 63%, the highest of all the percentages that Dr. McLarney gave us. And it's pre-engagement. So that's where we're starting at our starting point. Next steps might be to begin in July with staff and local engagement consultants to engage with groups and organizations to gather input and information useful in a future poll and future steps. We've developed four focus groups across each of the four subregions. True North Research would identify a consultant or a subconsultant with expertise in this special tax arena for transportation measures. And this group would advise and suggest improvements along the way, both for public engagement and then post-processing what has been heard out of the poll, as well as driving and helping public find their way to a website so that the average public person can give us their feedback as well. Now, following engagement, there would be additional polling that True North Research would do, and then staff would be developing and launching a website, preparing online and in-person surveys, and then working with all consultants. Right now in the budget, there is adequate funds to support these efforts. There is budget savings this fiscal year that would not be used, that would then carry over through an October amendment into next fiscal year to do these entire steps. So today, there are two timelines that are offered. As Dr. McLarney offered, keeping March alive at this point doesn't hurt anything. There doesn't have to be a decision today on this. The decision today is there a next step or not a next step? At a subsequent meeting, August, you tell us March or November if we are moving forward from today. Okay, so we're out of sync here a little bit because this is a slide from F2 and you haven't seen it yet. So right now, the RTP identifies $1.5 billion is necessary just to maintain the status quo of our current road conditions, the current number of potholes that are out there, the transit services and the senior transportation that's out there. That's $1.5 billion. The RTP identifies the need for $3.9 billion more for request improvements to safe routes to schools, to our highways, to our interchanges, to our downtowns, to our road maintenance. Looking at the RTP, we could constrain $3.1 billion and that left a $2.3 billion shortfall. Supplemental funding through this measure would, looking at the RTP still, $1.5 billion is the status quo. 3 out of 8 projects can be funded in the RTP. The other 5 cannot be funded for the foreseeable future. 2 out of 8 projects can be funded in the next 10 to 12 years. 5/8 or 62.5% are not fundable in the next 23 years. With supplemental funding, conservatively, it would raise $900 million over 20 years. It would leverage, likely, state funds totaling nearly $1 billion back to our region, completing our regional transportation plan, and every project in there and every pothole could be filled with those dollars if the plan was based on those needs. So, more information. Here you saw from Pete and his executive director's report, we have lots of plans. You know what's better than plans is having funds to build those things. And this is one of the things the board likes to do, is building and finishing what has been planned. But let's look forward to a HIP slide that you haven't seen yet on F3. And here's the HIP. What it's going to show you is that the transportation improvements of 59 projects in the Housing and Infrastructure Plan needs $618 million for 59 transportation projects. Cross-tabbing that with the RTP, 19 of those projects aren't fundable in the next 12 years. 6 of them will fall in the next 5 years out of 59, about 10%. Okay, let's look backwards now. Measure J in 2016 failed because it did not hit the two-thirds mark. We thought it would have raised $225 million in 2016. Today, if we had collected money, we would have $210 million collected and on the ground. In the next 2 years, another $70 million without including leveraging funds of probably about another $250 million. What did we miss out on? $143 million of local potholes and maintenance. We missed out on $25 million of safe routes to school. We missed out on $140 million of active transportation, $210 million investments to our highways, and $3 million a year to seniors and transit systems. That's what we missed out on. Here we are now, almost 8 years later. Nothing has changed. We continue to plan for the same needs and issues. We watch costs escalate for years and years due to delays, sometimes decades, until they die, until their costs are out of reach, and new problems and needs continue to mount. To solve our local transportation problems, we cannot rely on begging Sacramento for dollars for a project here or there. We need a local fund source of our own that can leverage Sacramento's dollars back to us, hundreds of millions of dollars of Sacramento dollars back to us. For us to do the most and best for local transportation, we need to do something different from the past two decades. That concludes the presentation and the tax unanimously supported staff recommendation here.
Questions for James? To my left, questions for James? Okay, we're going to go out to the public on this, and I have two requests to speak. Eric Greening, and Eric will be followed by Andreas Seastrand.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and very thorough presentation. If I didn't know you all and was just kind of facing a ballot measure in the abstract, what would be persuasive to me? What would push me in a negative direction? The most persuasive arguments that would push me toward a yes are the very significant difference between begging and programming, the local control, and the virtue of pay-as-you-go over debt. We are still paying for Proposition 1B and some of the massive wasteful projects in it. We are paying with interest that doubles the cost. And so there is an inherent superiority of measures that don't indebt us, that actually pay. It also helps create a prosperous environment rather than an inflationary environment. Debt always creates an inflationary environment. So those are on the persuasive side. What might dissuade me? Well, as a non-driver who has transportation struggles over and above everyone else's, those of who have a ready access to a car, if it was not sufficiently multimodal, taxing everyone, non-drivers and drivers alike, to subsidize primarily driving in an environment in which major changes and sacrifices are being rhetorically demanded relative to climate change, would seem to be a non-starter. Now, that may go contrary to the results of the poll, but if I saw an overwhelmingly road, especially if it was road expansion, I'm very much for maintaining our current investment in roads. But if I saw wasteful expansion and not much for transit or non-motorized, it would incline me to a no vote. The other thing that would incline me to a no vote would be unsupported claims, and I think the greatest vulnerability in the 2016 campaign was the claim that half the cost would be paid by visitors, and this was made based on modeling rather than data. If such claims are going to be made in a future campaign, the time to start gathering the data is now, because the models were not believable. Anyway, that's That's where I would be standing if I didn't know you all and was just coming to this raw. Those are kind of the things that would push my vote in one direction or another. I hope that's useful information. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Andrea?
Good morning, members of SLOCOG. Andrea C. Strand, president of the Central Coast Taxpayers Association, better known as CCTA. Well, here we are, back to the future, Measure J 2016, all over again. You know, at that time, CCTA opposed the use of forgotten taxpayer dollars to be used to hire consultants to poll voters regarding a tax increase and using those public funds to promote the increase in the sales tax. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were used for that purpose, and then a supplemental voter information pamphlet was mailed to all the voters in the county to support Measure J. And I will tell you, if you look at the 30 pages, 29 are all in favor of Measure J, with one page dedicated to rebuttals. Well, I will say that I talked with Tommy Gong about this pamphlet and asked, what did it cost? He estimated $100,000 to $120,000 to mail to all those voters. Now, that's years ago, so you can imagine if we were to do it again today regarding the high inflation rate. I remind you that after all those forgotten taxpayer dollars were used to try to convince voters to support Measure J, the measure failed. Yes, you heard it today. Failed to not receive the 66% of the vote. It's interesting to note that California law specifically states it's a felony for public officials to use public funds, taxpayer dollars, for campaign activities. I would say that the supplemental information pamphlet was just that. Well, I could go on about Measure J, but here we are again, hiring consultants to poll voters regarding the possible sales tax increase. Well, let's do a reality check. The Tribune recently reported these are days of uncertainty. Governor Newsom also stated that the outlook is uncertain, predicts more unemployment, slow growth. There's a California $32 billion deficit and the possibility of a county deficit, and perhaps your individual cities are facing a deficit. The household debt is soaring, as well as credit card debt. And public service, as public servants, you know your constituents are checking their budgets. They have to put food on the table, gas in the gas tank, and a roof over their head. But here you are looking at hiring more consultants to poll for an increase. I just want to end by saying that CCTA will be monitoring you to ensure that the public is fully aware if you pursue the same Measure J abusive and illegal approach to using taxpayer dollars to promote a tax measure increase in the sales tax. And I'll end on this also. Here is a list of all the possible tax increases that the voters will be looking at. Maybe it's March 2024, or probably more likely March or November 2024. And we don't know what our state legislature or our federal Congress will be doing in the meantime. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrea. Okay, we're going to bring it back to the board for comments and a discussion. I ask the board members, Pete, I'm looking at staff recommendations, or I'm looking at what you're asking us to do today. So I heard kind of a conflicting thing here. It looks like you're asking us to receive the polling results and then also to approve a contract with Dr. McClarney, it looks like, with True North Research to continue efforts in the direction of...
That's right.
Okay.
You know, we're not making a decision on March. We're not making a decision on November. We're just making a decision to continue with the process we're on to... evaluate and educate whether or not there's a pathway to a measure. You know, we can look backwards to Measure J, but our job is really to look forwards. And you know, our job is to really bring transportation projects forward and make sure that they're funded and connect communities. And this is a pathway to do it.
Correct. So, James, did you have anything else? I just wanted to make it clear what. As we start to discuss what we're being asked to vote on today.
I think be hit on the head.
Okay.
Be hit on the head, but I would want to clarify with legal counsel. whether or not we're doing anything illegal with our funding at this point in time, or if we're promoting a measure inappropriately. I'd love legal counsel to weigh in on that, if that's
thank
okay.
You.
Good morning, Jenna Morton, Chief Deputy County Counsel. So there's nothing that would prohibit the SLOCOG board from doing its due diligence to decide whether to put a measure on the ballot. The rules change significantly once a resolution is brought and the measure is a ballot measure.
Okay.
But at this point, it's complete
this is
due
research.
Diligence. Correct.
Thank you. Okay, then deliberations on this, and I'll start to my right. Comments, questions, Jim?
Yes, yeah, so just under comment, I mean, we saw the $140 million that wasn't collected for fixing roads and potholes, but I think that assumes that all of the tax measures that cities passed after this failure that passed in 2020 would have passed anyway. And I think that a lot of the work that cities have done, Arroyo Grande's unfortunately didn't pass, would may not have been supported if, in fact, there was already money going to transportation through the county. So I'm going to support this today because I do think it's definitely worth going forward. But I am concerned about, we talked about the competing measures, and I do think the city measures are essential to many of our cities. So,
yes. Thank you. John?
Yeah, I agree with Jim. The competing measures do hurt the local ones, but I don't support this. This is a tax increase right now in a really, really bad economic time. It's coming if you don't hear it. And I think you saw that in the polling that was just presented to us on the negatives. And I'll just read it to you again. The county is already an expensive place to live, especially for young families, seniors, those on fixed incomes. Passing a sales tax increase at this time will make it less affordable. And I think that is a very, very strong message, and I think that's what will be used to defeat it.
Andy?
Thank you so much. I think the polling results were super helpful and informative, and I think those negative concerns are real in terms of the cost of living here. I also think that the leaving the money on the table, that we're not able to capture free money from that other counties are able to get is pretty compelling, that loss of being able to support our local projects. So I will be supporting it and with an open mind. If it's not the right time, it's not the right time, but let's keep getting the information.
Ed?
Thank you. I've always been of two minds on this kind of a measure, but I always go back to what, in fact, Board Member P said, which is the way the system that the state set up is that if you don't tax yourself, they won't give you additional money that you've already paid to the state anyway. So the system is set up that we would not get as much from the state without the local sales tax. So we're leaving money on the table that we can't get. So the other thing is we do need to, part of our economic progress depends upon being able to move people around, move goods around, and we have a lot of work to do. I will support it, but I'm going to support this what's before us, and I'll withhold judgment on whether I'll vote for a final go-ahead. I would like to get some more information, especially on competing tax measures. So I will reluctantly support this, but we'll see where we go next. Thank you.
Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate Mr. Waggie's thoughtful consideration of where we are and what we need to do. You know, we should be a self-help county. We have lost tremendous opportunity because we're not. And I think the next steps are obvious and necessary. We need to engage our community to find out what sorts of things they want to see accomplished and to craft a measure that will speak to that. And we can hope that we can get over that 300 vote hump that set us back so badly when Major J failed. So obviously I will support this today.
Great. Jimmy?
Thank you, Chair. I would just really just remind our board that, you know, this is about quality of life for our constituents and about giving them the choice. You know, ultimately, if economic considerations are Mr. Pashong mentioned, are the most prevailing considerations, then we'll see that. We would see that in a vote down for this particular measure. But to give the constituents, our citizens, an opportunity to say, well, we acknowledge that this is going to be, not only good for road maintenance and safety and all of that, but for our economy in general. We know, for example, that active transportation is a draw and a direct nexus to tourism and a benefit to our local economy. And so I just would hope that we consider that even, well, as we continue to explore next steps and get more information. The other thing I'd like to echo from Mr. Waggy is just that this really is local control. It's about keeping money here local under the control of this board and our local jurisdictions, and the money cannot be reallocated by the state, and that's oftentimes a concern that I hear directly from my constituents, that there's just a mistrust at that level. And if we were able to convey that message that this can be done in a transparent and accountable way, then I think we could really make some inroads with people that are skeptical. And then I wanted to respond to the concern raised by Ms. Seastrand regarding the prior Measure J effort. And there was an FPPC investigation related to Measure J, and they found that there, and I'm reading directly from their decision, insufficient evidence to find any violation, and the matter was closed. And so SLOCOG, in its efforts related to polling, education outreach, was found by law to be in compliance. And then just finally, I hope that we can continue to have strategic level discussions with the cities. I served on the Rio Grande City Council. I understand the city perspective. I voted to support a sales tax measure, which failed. And they're going to be going, apparently, in either March or November of next year. So we definitely want to minimize competing measures if there's any way we can coordinate. For example, if the polling's indicating that we have an equal shot by going in March and cities are planning on going in November, then that could be a strategic approach to maximizing benefit for all of us. So I support moving forward at this time. Thank you.
Okay, done.
Thank you. Well, everybody made some really good points. And, I apologize that, my departure here prevented Sarah's presentation in regards to the infrastructure, because I think that's even more compelling in regards to why is it unaffordable, what is it going to take for us to be able to build some more housing here, in particularly the areas where there's availability, but not the infrastructure. And when I look out to the audience and I see younger folks, I really think it is our responsibility to be thinking about how we're going to provide them with the future, and that while I agree with what Supervisor Paulding said, and is one of my points, is that City of SLO has its measures. There's measures already in place in places, and yet we really haven't put together the argument in regards to how can we put each half a penny together to make even bigger money for all of us. And I think that that's really important. So I support this, and hoping that we can kind of hone in on some of that strategic way of looking at the future and being able to work together, because since we're regionalism is so key here, and that we are the only county surrounded that's not self-help. So anyway, those are some thoughts. Thank you.
Anybody else? I have a quick comment. It's kind of a repeat for most of you, and I promise I'll only say it once, and then throughout this year I will not do this again. But I do want to say, I want to give the reason, awkward, that I won't be supporting this again. And sorry, Pete, I know you've heard this out of my mouth so many times. But I'll tell you what, I have no doubt in my mind, and Dr. McClarney, thank you very much. It's always interesting to have formal polling if you're still listening to us. I have no doubt in my mind that poll wasn't 100% correct. I've run for local office here at the county level 4 times, and my whole campaign was based on I'm going to vote for road improvements and maintenance of our infrastructure, and I got elected. So there's a sort of a poll that people really care about that. They have cared about it for a long time, and that's what they want to see. Therein lies the problem. And sometimes I'm embarrassed when I read the minutes, and I'm the no vote, only no vote out of the whole board. But I think the message has to be continually put out there for the people. I always tell my colleagues on these different boards, we're in kind of a funny spot because we're supposed to be sitting on this board and we're supposed to be getting projects done. Everyone that works for this agency, I do not hold it against you that you're trying to get, you can't do projects without money, and you never get money. You never get money. So my message sometimes is symbolic, and I know that, but what I think people are tired of, I'm a lifelong taxpayer here, and I think what we're tired of is the prioritization of our tax dollars. We all pay taxes to a lot of different levels of government. And we oftentimes think, really, they're spending all our money on that again, that kind of thing. And I believe that, you know, taxpayers in California really, really, really want their roads improved and maintained and sometimes expanded. But they don't very often get that. So an example, we have spent for the last, and Gus is in the house, he knows more about all this stuff than I do, but we've spent our state so much money on high-speed rail, and it's still just there without any results. When people see that, people like me, I think, man, no good. How do we ever get the attention of our electeds to say, we the citizens want money put on maintaining our infrastructure and our roads? So even here at the county, our new board majority voted just the other day to take road maintenance off of the budget priority as we head into working on our annual budget. Road maintenance is no longer a priority at the county level even. Now, how can we convince taxpayers, you know what, dig in your pocket, and if you'll put more money in your out of your pocket and set it out there on the table, we'll work towards getting a match. And you know what, I'm not wishing this away. If you succeed, then I'm going to say, good for you that the taxpayers are willing to do that. But somebody needs to call it out for what it is. A lot of this is not prioritizing your tax dollars at every level to match the needs of the public and the promises that government has made. We're here to provide public safety infrastructure that we all as citizens pool our money to build. And I think that I'm going to just continue to try to carry that message. And hopefully my goal and the things I'm saying right now is to bring some responsibility and accountability to, you know, these agencies at every level so that we may be able to do what I think is government's most important responsibility. So I'll stop, and that's why I'm not going to be supporting this.
Madam Chair, if I might, brief comments. As to priorities, I would point out that the polling clearly showed that addressing homelessness was the number one priority in those contacted. And while I am tempted to add direction to staff to investigate doing projects without money, I'm simply going to move staff's recommendation.
I'll second.
Okay, and then Jimmy, under discussion, it looks like you wanted to say something.
Oh, yeah, under discussion, I was going to actually make that point, just that I saw in the polling that homelessness did poll as the number one priority. That's what our board established as priorities.
Yep.
And that we also, just so for those here and those watching from home, we didn't cut the level of funding to our roads at a county level. We simply have a maintenance of effort agreement that requires X amount of dollars to go toward roads. So just wanted to echo that comment and second this motion. Those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Okay. I think we have anybody else? I think we have a motion and a second, and we can ask for a roll call vote, please.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Paulding?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
For reasons previously stated, no.
Board Member Ortiz Legg?
Yes.
Board Member Pichon?
No.
Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Iwagi?
Yes.
Board Member Wixom?
No.
Vice President Pease?
Yes.
President Arnold.
Drum roll. Anybody want to guess? That would be a no. Thank you. Thank you, Ida.
One, two, three, four, six, seven. The motion carried.
Great. Okay. Thank you. And thank you, everyone. James, thank you. And Dr. McLarney, if you're out there, thank you. And thank you. And right now, then, we'll move back on our agenda to F1, and that will be John. He's ready to go.
Okay, good morning, Chair Arnold and Slocog Board, John D'Annunzio, Slocog staff, here to present the amendment number 5 to the 2023 FTIP. This is an item that requires a public hearing. Just a bit of background, you know, what is the FTIP? It includes all of our federally funded and regionally significant projects. It's a 4-year document. We update it every 2 years. Projects have to be in the regional transportation plan, air quality, conformity, consistency, performance measures, consistency. The projects have to be fiscally constrained. So any project has to be in this document, record keeping, in order to access federal funding. So the picture, the features and highlights of the document, this is fiscal year 22-23 through 25-26. There's 106 projects and grouped programs, and we'll be talking more about grouping here in a moment. This is our federal, state, and local funding of approximately $608 million in a 4-year cycle. And you can learn more about this at slocog.org on the funding page. And this particular amendment increases programming capacity by $8 million. But as you'll see in a moment, we are doing some deprogramming. Bringing the pain forward, we'll be deprogramming $6.2 million on the Briscoe Road interchange. This was Alt 4C, the roundabout project. The silver lining in that is that the 6.2 is not lost to our region, that's coming back at a future date. We will also be deprogramming $5.2 million for the Templeton-Atascadero connector, where $3.2 million of that will return to the state alone, but $2 million of that comes back to our region in a future STIP cycle. As I mentioned before about taking some projects and putting them into groups, it's really just a way to exercise administrative control over the FTIP. So 4 of the projects that we have as individually listed projects along the 227, Farmhouse Lane, Buckley Road, Los Ranchos Road, Crestmont, and Biddle, will be put into a new group project called intersection channelization. This programming item also programs $1.3 million of the COVID CRISA funding, non-STIP, these are SAFE funds, as Executive Pete Rogers mentioned earlier. So this money is safe. However, we'll be decreasing some CMAQ funds in this action as well. We'll also be creating a new administrative grouping for rideshare program. So this combines the 4 programs, van pooling, regional TDM, the slow regional rideshare learn by doing, and the rideshare bike locker program. As this these programs go from strength to strength. Having them in a group makes sense administratively. We'll also be doing the same for our bicycle and pedestrian facilities and creating a new administrative grouping. So this is an opportunity for the community of Arroyo Grande's Swinging Bridge Rehabilitation Project. They were awarded $500,000 in congressional community funding money. This was cycle 2 of that. They're also including a local match. So this administratively puts in the FTIP, and then once after today, you'll be able to access that money once the state signs off on it. Similarly, this paves the way for the El Camino Real, the downtown improvements in Atascadero. As we wait, you'll see it says asterisk and pending cycle 3 for the $2 million that has been earmarked for that. Additionally, the North Coast All-American Multi-Road Use Trail or Chorro Valley Trail. So this is the segment from Cal Poly out to Cuesta College. We're seeking environmental design money for that from Congress, as well as additional construction funding for the Edna Valley Trail segment along the 227. So all those will be in a nice, tidy group. Amendment number 5 also takes action for City of Slo's Prado Road. This is committed funding from Congress. It's an additional approximately $2 million plus a local match. There is more local match on that project, but this is what was needed to put administratively into the FTIP. And then we are deprogramming or moving programming off. We're not deprogramming it. It will come back next cycle. $250,000 of federal highway improvement program. This is a different HIP than you'll be hearing about in a minute. We were trying to keep the federal money out of this for pre-construction so that it moves quicker. So that's the strategy. We'll see if it works. And then grouping projects for the regional transit. You'll see that there's some security camera upgrades in one of the groups, and then upgrading diesel and gas vehicles. These are not electric vehicles there. So that concludes the staff report for Amendment Number 5 of the 2023 FTIP. Staff recommends adopting the resolution to approve this amendment. I am available for questions, and TTAC and CTAC supported these recommendations.
Questions for John? Questions? John, I have a quick question. The one project near and dear to my heart was the connector, the Atascadero-Templeton connector, but that didn't have to do with funding. That had to do with railroad issues, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We just could never get it done or get through it. Do you think that will sit off to the side, or do you think that's just put to bed for a while?
Everyone has tried so hard on that project, and the great engineering minds that we have at the county and at Caltrans and all staff, we've worked really, really hard on that, and it's a huge disappointment. I'd like to think it's just a pause, and who knows what the future holds.
Are we still looking to another route, or are we just, we have other things, and now we're setting it aside? Do you think?
The preferred approach now is to work more cooperatively with Union Pacific to do a grade separated crossing versus the staying on the west side of the railroad alignment. So from my understanding, the project development team is working on a grade.
So we're still working
yes.
on it, but that sounds like a much more expensive decision.
Yes, it will be. It'll come back and it'll be more expensive, and we'll need discretionary state ATP funds.
And that project's been in the pipeline for many years, so
yep.
kind of at a start over point. I'm asking you those questions so I can answer the same question that I get asked about it. So thank you. Anybody think of other questions? Okay, I don't have any requests to speak. If anyone would like to speak on this item, come forward. I don't see anybody, so I'm in a look for a motion.
Yeah, I move staff recommendation to adopt amendment number 5.
Ed Waggy, second.
Okay, great. We have a motion and a second. Ida, you got all that? As Andy and Ed?
Ed.
And this is a roll call vote.
Vice President Pease?
Yes.
Board Member Waggy?
Yes.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
Yes.
Board Member Paulding?
Yes.
Board Member Shaw? Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Wixom?
Yes.
President Arnold?
Yes.
The motion passed.
Okay. And then I think for the record, Supervisor Pashong and Supervisor Ortiz Lake have left for the remainder of the meeting. So I've had a request on just a 5-minute quick break, so we'll do that, and then we'll come back on F2. 5 minutes. So what is it? 10:33? At 10:40.
Break at 10:33.
Okie doke. We're ready to go.
The staff were there too. No, we actually didn't have staff today.
Okay. We are going to get this party going again. No problem. Yeah. Okay. We're going to move forward on our agenda to item number F2. And James, you're up again. Do we have... That's what happens when we have a break. We lose some of our people, but they'll be back. Oh, here comes Heather. We have enough.
So here we are on our long-range regional transportation plan. And by long, I don't mean the 13 board meetings you've had on this or the 2.5 years we've been talking about it, but it's our 23-year look to the future. You can probably do this presentation as well as I can, but for the members of the public that are watching, there are four major elements to this plan, and through the plan efforts and its contents, we've met all of our challenges. The policy element includes a vision, it includes our 7 goals and our pillars, and A through H bullets here, and the other bullets that will take us all the way through Z are past board meeting milestones that were reviewed by steering committee members and TACs, as well as the board, and we had significant public engagement efforts throughout the development of this plan. The financial element, you have seen this earlier on the F4 item, where we have $3.1 billion constrained. We have our state, our federal, our local monies. We have a $2.3 billion unconstrained picture. We have $1.5 billion just to maintain our streets, roads, transit as they are today for the next 23 years. And then we can add another $1.6 billion to do 3 out of 8 projects, or 3 out of $8 that we have available. Our action element identifies where we spend the money, whether it's highways or maintenance or transit or active transportation, and there's shortfalls in the hundreds of millions of dollars in each one of those categories across the board. The Sustainable Community Strategy, or SCS, shows how we're going to grow. And for this, we use the now awarded transportation efficiency analysis. We use the jobs housing balance to spread the new growth that is coming of 42,000 new people, 18,000 new jobs, 18,000 new homes in order to hit our targets. Public review on this plan ran for more than 55 days. We did receive over 100 written and verbal comments. We prepared responses to these. We did have some minor changes, fixes for hyperlinks and corrections and formatting. Some project tweaks where city staff identified some projects shouldn't be in certain lists or should be in different lists. And we did add 2 unconstrained projects, one on a Creston intersection and another on a coastal trail connector. Again, both unconstrained projects. And here we are today to consider adoption of this plan. The staff recommendation is to adopt the resolution approving the 2023 RTP with consideration of the 2019 RTP SCS PEIR and the 2023 addendum that has been prepared. And I'm happy to take any questions on this at this time.
Questions for James? Questions on this side? No questions? We do have one request to speak on this. Thank you, James. Eric Greening.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I'd like to thank all the people who worked on this. I know it was a mammoth effort, and I'm basically in alignment with most of it. You've read my comments, and I do appreciate the responses to the comments. Most of the comments were responded to in very constructive ways. And the one that wasn't, it was basically the statement that concern over the electromagnetic smog is a federal issue. They've preempted it, so we're not going to touch it. I still think that is an outrage in the face of rising health data, rising ecological data, pollinator effects, et cetera, from the increasing demands of quote-unquote intelligent systems, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is not at all casting aspersions on the broadband piece of it, because my understanding is that is wired connections, and those are relatively benign in terms of their emissions. But I was hoping for a quantification of the electromagnetic smog impacts of everything considered under quote-unquote intelligent transportation systems, whether we are preempted from mitigating or addressing those impacts or not. The responsible thing is to know whether we're causing them. Maybe we are, maybe we aren't. I don't know. I just know that when I hear intelligent or AI or 5G or any of these other things none of us ask for that are coming over us like an avalanche, and that those of us with neurological issues feel directly, personally, as attacks on our health, there need to be voices of the people we've elected to represent us raising these issues whenever and wherever they can. So with that caveat, I do urge your adoption of a very well-crafted regional transportation plan. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other requests to speak, so I will ask for a motion.
Yes, I'd be happy to make a motion, and I do have a quick comment, which is, again, appreciation for all the effort. We've hashed through it in great detail. The one comment that I had had was just asking for more programs to increase transit frequency and hours. It doesn't fit in the constraint. I think the staff response is appropriate, but I will be continuing to look for opportunities in the future to have more robust transit throughout our whole region. So with that, I'll move approval of the final RTP.
Second. And under discussion, if I might, Madam Chair, you know, Mr. Worthley referenced the amount of time it's taken. It speaks to the complexity of this and the scale when we get to a regional transportation plan. I think the thing that we should really focus on is the fact that less than half of the projects that we see important for this region are unfunded at this point, have no particular likelihood to be funded. Amazingly, relative to 10 years ago or so, that's an improvement. Used to be that only about a quarter of what we imagined, and it's only, or not only, it is in large part because we have gotten more real about what we should put in the RTP. It's not like we've got a whole lot more money. We've got a lot less ambition, and that's a sad commentary. So with that, I'm fully supportive of this, which, of course, we have to do. I appreciate the very thoughtful approach, the wide community engagement, and all the work that staff did to get it to where it is, and look forward to seeing it become reality at some point.
Did you have a comment? No? Okay. Any other comments, questions from the board, under discussion from the board? Then we'll go ahead and ask for a roll call vote on this, please.
Vice President Pease?
Yes.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
Yes.
Board Member Paulding?
Yes.
Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Waggy?
Yes.
Board Member Wexum?
Yes.
President Arnold?
Yes.
The motion passed.
Thank you. We're going to move on to item F3, our regional housing and infrastructure plan, and that's Sarah. And I want to just say welcome back to the board chambers. How does it feel to be sitting in the board chambers, Carolyn, after all those many hours you used to spend with us here? So happy to see you. Thank you, Sarah.
Good morning, President Arnold and board, Sarah Sanders, Slocog staff, and I am joined by part of the outreach team, Carolyn Berg of Cobalt Collaborative. Today we're going to go over the draft Regional Housing and Infrastructure Plan, or the HIP. So we've made a lot of progress over the last 6 months. I'll begin with where we started, dig a little bit deeper with a few of the HIP elements. Carolyn will go over the stakeholder engagement piece, and I will close out with where we're going to go from here. So before we dive in, let's refresh our memories on exactly where we fit into the whole housing process. So the state determines the number of units needed every 8 years through the regional housing needs allocation process. This is typically an unfunded mandate, but recently the Housing and Community Development Department has provided sporadic funding programs like SB2, which funds the HIP, REAP, and LEAP. Working with all eight jurisdictions, SLOCOG allocates those units. Your staff in the Planning or Community Development Departments plan for those units through housing element updates, and the builders and developers build those units. So this is all important because the RENA process was essentially the catalyst for the whole HIP idea. And it shows that government plays a role in housing, but not the only role. Back in 2019, the County Board of Supervisors approved the kickoff of this effort with three main goals. Regional collaboration was accomplished through the 2020 Regional Compact, which all of your jurisdictions and SLOCOG signed. Your jurisdictions added a regional section to the updated housing elements in 2020, and we're closing out on the strategic action plan with the 2023 HIP. So a year ago, SLOCOG committed to bringing this phase of the effort to the finish line before September 2023. That's when this grant sunsets. We committed to inventory the water, wastewater, and transportation barriers to housing. We're identifying funding to implement those needs through the funding strategies assessment, and we're setting up the foundation for the next regional housing needs allocation. And we even added the affordable by design study, which was requested by your staff. So there are seven elements to the this phase of the HIP. They include the data and project inventory, the housing efficiency analysis, the infrastructure prioritization, the mapping tool, the affordable by design study, the funding strategies assessment, and the housing highlights. So it's a lot that has being worked on in the last 6 months. To get the highest impact, housing efficient areas were identified. These areas have transportation access, water and wastewater capacity. The infrastructure needed in both the efficient and potential areas moved on to the infrastructure needs list to be prioritized. Through the process, 444 total water, wastewater, and transportation projects were collected. 80 of those were identified as HIP projects and were moved on to be prioritized. So, after guidance from the stakeholders, projects were prioritized using a three-tiered approach, high, medium, and low. The main factor was the benefit cost, which was calculated by total proposed units within the specific community by the total project cost. These 80 projects come with a combined need of over $1 billion. One-fourth of the projects are water-related, and the remaining are transportation. The majority of the HIP projects are ranked high and come at one-third of the cost of the total need. So Jaden did a fantastic job on the HIP mapping tool, which includes the 80 projects, the housing efficient areas, a story map going through the analysis process, and additional information. So to provide a fuller picture, flood hazard, sensitive habitat, open space, prime farmland, hazard severity data were all included as additional reference information. These were not used to remove any of the infrastructure projects, but are there to provide additional context. And the affordable by design study, we call it the ABD study. It's something your planning staff wanted for HCD reporting, annual reporting. And the study was intended to show certain units built without financial assistance or deed restrictions as either low or moderate income units. The consultant, Echo Northwest, split the county into four regional markets to identify common characteristics. They did a financial feasibility analysis, for the development of the prototypes and identified regulatory barriers. They'll be finishing up the ABD study by highlighting potential policy measures that can be implemented. So on the rental side, the market is close, and regulatory change could help produce these kind of units. Most of the buildings that fit this definition are three-story buildings with smaller average units. But not all small units are affordable. It depends on the subregion. And then for the for sale side of the market, housing production needs to get into balance before we can even contemplate ABD, and it could be achievable. The only units that they found recently that fit within the for sale side are manufactured homes, and that's not including the lot cost. So the study, there's more information on the staff report and the attachments, but it's sobering, but it's not surprising. So to take a step back, the consultant wanted to really hone in on what creates a market that can produce lower cost housing. And there are four factors that have to come together in a market to produce this kind of housing. And it would be simple design, lower cost location, efficient production, and smaller units with higher density. Now, how does the public sector impact these market conditions? So through discretionary review processes, zoning standards for characteristics like lot sizes, density, and design, and with stakeholder guidance, Northwest is now creating a menu of voluntary ABD policies that will be coming to your board in August. So now I'm going to pass the presentation over to Carolyn. She'll go over the engagement piece.
Good morning, board. Carolyn Berg, Coble Collaborative, and thank you for the welcome, President Arnold. I am happy to be back in the chambers and working on this project with Sarah Sanders and team. I think it's really compelling what Sarah started off the whole presentation with, and I know your board has talked about there are a lot of different agencies involved when it comes to housing, and it's no burden that one agency can realistically hold, whether it's private or public. So I think that's a great place to start when we talk about engagement, and for some reason the slides have gone away, but hopefully you've got them in front of you. So I think it's important that SLOCOG's board is taking on this project, but beyond that, each of you represent a community, a council, or a board, and it's important that this effort be engaging of all of those communities and all of those jurisdictions. And so that's a bit of the work that we did was the engagement on the back end, and now it's moving into your hands and into your council's and board's counterparts' hands moving forward. The HIP mission, thanks, I have the clicker. The HIP's mission has always had strong collaboration at its core. And as I mentioned, it is SLOCOG driving this plan, but it is not your plan alone. It's meant to be a collective regional plan. And so, of course, engagement and communication were critical to making that happen. Sarah briefly touched on the phase strategy. And I wanted to just go back because this is so fundamental in that idea of it takes action by many to move this forward. So as she stated, the regional collaboration was formalized with the first step in early 2020 when each of your councils and boards, as well as SLOCOG's board, adopted a united vision for looking at how could we create a more resilient infrastructure system, adequate housing supply, and support economic prosperity. So how can we hold all of those goals together and start making real progress? And that was unanimously approved by 40 elected officials across all cities and boards with a lot of support from key stakeholders in private industry. And then goal two, as Sarah mentioned, that was creating a regional chapter within the housing elements that each jurisdiction that has land use authority approved. And within that, there were regional policies, aspirational paths forward. And both of those first goals also called for the importance of this HIP, basically. It was looking for how do we have some kind of tools and ideas of what it looks like to move forward together and make the most impactful decisions when it comes to funding or infrastructure at a regional level. And so there's a lot on this screen, but what we wanted to convey is there has been a lot of stakeholder engagement compressed in a very short time frame. So SLOCOG took on the project in October and had about a year to turn this project around. And so in that time, because it's not just SLOCOG that will be implementing the plan, we tried to really tailor our stakeholder engagement to incorporate people from private and public and nonprofit industries across all jurisdictions, from elected level to staff level. So really looking for depth and breadth of stakeholders that were engaged. And primary work started as Sarah's team and the consulting teams were producing more and more information. And then Reach and I were able to work with Sarah to get in front of stakeholders and start providing information about what the HIP is and seeking their input on a variety of things, such as the strengths and challenges that our region faces when we talk about housing or infrastructure, or getting input on what their housing plans are in the region and double-checking with developers that we actually have accurate information included in the plan. So there was a lot happening just over the last 6 months especially. We engaged starting with your leadership, so city managers, Pete Rogers as your executive director, and the county administrative officer have all been foundational in making every step of this phased approach happen. And so they helped in December with kicking off this process and making sure that we were headed in the right direction and involving the right stakeholders. We've also been meeting through Sarah with the Housing Action Team every month. So that includes a community development and planning directors or staff for each of the cities, county, and SLOCOG. So they're helping to provide more of that boots on the ground information. We had our building and developer group meeting every quarter. And so they've been providing more of the how do we build this and fund this moving forward. So that was developers, builders, architects, real estate, and a number of others. And then our final three groups, so housing advocacy group, that was more of our those who influence housing directly. So our nonprofit builders, League of Women Voters has been doing a lot of work in this space, chambers, and Home Builders Association. And then finally, we have two of your board members who are involved on our HIP steering committee. And that group was meant to help us integrate. So that's a lot of different stakeholders' feedback to bring into the fold. And so we created a very intentional 10-member group that had representatives from each of these stakeholder groups to make sure that we were really addressing what we needed to and engaging the stakeholders that were necessary. So all of that work leads to today, which is pending your board's action will kick us into the community support phase of this. And Sarah Sanders and or her team and Reach and I will be going out and doing a road show basically to all of the cities and the county board. And so here's a list of those dates coming up, pending your board action. So June 27th, we'll be with Morro Bay and Atascadero, the 11th with SLO, and on until we get to your August 2nd board date where you consider adoption of the plan and receive any feedback that might have come through the city councils and board meetings. And then we'll round out with August 8th going to the county board of supervisors as the grant grantee of this effort and having them close out the support phase of this. And with that, I'll hand it back to Sarah.
Great. So we're almost at the finish line. Okay, so like Carolyn said, we're going to go for some community support with all of your city councils and the board, supervisors. We are finishing up the Affordable by Design study. You're going to see the full funding strategies assessment, and this is just linking each infrastructure project, so those 80 HIP projects, with viable grant funding sources. And so you'll see a whole report on that. There are a few attachments already started from the consultant, and then they're working on a gap analysis, and then we'll come back to this board, your board, in August with all of the consultant teams. And so staff recommends that the board review and provide any comment on the HIP and direct staff to present this item to member jurisdictions for comment and seek general support of regional collaboration moving forward. And both TTAC and CTAC had full discussions and provided some great comments on the draft. And this concludes staff's formal presentation.
Thank you, Sarah. Do we have questions for Sarah, Carolyn? Heather?
Thank you, Carolyn. And I wanted to say both Vice Chair Pease and I were the two members that got to serve on that steering committee. And really, just a very, what a tremendous job that you've done bringing all of this information together, pulling very, you know, just different perspectives and needs and pulling all that together. So thank you for that. The piece where you talked about the grant possibilities. I'm wondering, does that tie in with Grant Camp? Is there any tie-in there or any way that there could be or should be?
Not necessarily. The Grant Camp is focused on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And I think a lot of the water and sewer grants will be very different. But, you know, in our work with the Ferguson Group, we do see those grants. So maybe there is an opportunity to broaden the scope of the Grant Camp to include. So a good suggestion.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Any Supervisor Gibson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in the intent of the funding strategies. It's an assessment at this point, but in terms of going to the various jurisdictions, is there? My understanding is that HIP is an action plan. So the question is there going to be a request for commitment from jurisdictions to actually do something about this?
We'll be going to the jurisdictions and asking them for a recommitment to the compact. So this whole plan is voluntary. So everything, it's just a study. So people can take what they want and make it their own. So there's no formal commitment when it comes to like doing anything with the funding strategies assessment. It's just essentially connecting the projects with some grant opportunities and seeing how viable they are with those.
So basically we're waiting for individual jurisdictions or jurisdictions acting as a reason as a regional cooperative, shall we say, to take on this and make commitments to actually doing something about it.
Yes, so we SLOCOG committed to providing the opportunity and the knowledge going forward, but we don't have land use authority, so it's going to be up to each one of your local jurisdictions to implement what they see fit for their community.
Okay. And I'm looking at Appendix C, which is the funding strategies assessment, and under the transportation tab, I can't decipher all of the acronyms, but is self-help status of the county in there as a funding strategy? I don't see it immediately.
No, they just focused on grants.
So let me gently observe that, you know, there's a concept of pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps, and I think that's a pretty significant oversight not to include self-help status for the transportation chunk, which Mr. Worthley's presentation was suggested to be a very significant part of $1 billion that we need overall.
I'll make note and have the consultant look at that as part of the analysis.
Jimmy?
Thank you, Chair. I first want to just commend your efforts, and Carolyn, thank you for being here as well, in addition to Sarah, and the presentation's great. I also am kind of trying to visualize the steps after the compact. So let's say that all seven cities are like, yeah, this is great, and then it comes to the county, and the county ratifies it or authorizes it, approves it. And then we're talking about what's the next step and really an implementation plan region-wide and what the role of this board is to help convene that planning effort. Essentially what you're saying is we haven't got there yet, right? Those are future steps, and individual jurisdictions obviously retain their land use authority and ability to look at this plan, look at all of the green areas on the map, all the efficient areas, and say, oh, maybe we should update our land use element accordingly and implement, you know, some changes, maybe upzone, whatever it is. Am I on the right track there?
Yep.
Okay. So, yeah, it does seem that it would be important to continue a regional conversation after, like basically post completion of this plan around collaborative efforts in implementing the regional compact. And even if it gets to a point where cities maybe push back and say, look, This is a highly political subject. You know, we're working on our own set of goals around our land use planning, et cetera. Back off, that's fine. But I don't think any regional body really has gotten to that point in the past. And it's important, more important now than ever. And so I guess that would be my observation. Ideally, we would have a regional compact with a regional implementation plan that shows the opportunity zones we've identified through this really important analysis that shares a policy methodology that each jurisdiction could utilize as to what tools could be used to implement that level of housing. And maybe the commitment, you know, to do it is the part that becomes political and doesn't happen, but at least we go that next step. So anyway, just some observations for our board at this time. Thank you.
Ed.
Yeah, I was going to make pretty much the same statement that Mr. Paulding did. I think that what are the next steps? Certainly we can look at our various housing policies and so forth. The infrastructure is one of the big ones, too. Supervisor
Gibson. Bruce, you can call me Bruce.
I had a long meeting last two nights. I'm a little foggy this morning. No, I appreciate, I guess I'm looking at the next steps as well, that we've made a lot of progress. I appreciate all the effort that you've made on moving this forward. We were trying to find some organization to take on this regional planning effort for housing along with infrastructure, and this body took it on, and I appreciate that you've got to this point. I think after we get, after all the presentations to all the local government agencies, then we'll see, I think, where we go next as this body. How do we keep this moving forward? Or we just make the presentations and it dies? Because there's a lot of effort that we'll have to undertake to move this forward. Thank you.
With no other lights on, if I might follow on, Madam Chair, I mean, that's my point. Are we actually going to do something about it? And I applaud all the analysis that's going on. The regional compact that came before us a couple of years ago was the easiest thing in the world to vote for. You know, who doesn't like cooperation? You know, that was a total feel-good moment that really didn't commit anybody to anything. And that's why I asked this question, because, you know, pursuing further action on a regional compact, again, I don't see it gets us down the path to actually getting something done. What we need is a binding regional contract, not a compact, and a commitment. And that's going to take political will, and that's going to take money, and that's going to take asking tough questions and having difficult conversations. And so, the commitment of a regional body, and this one's as good as any and seems to be the proper focus for where this should happen. You know, I remain to see that collectively we have the necessary political will to make good on all the good observations that have been put into this plan. And so I know it's not necessarily the role of SLOCOG staff to point out to the individual jurisdictions that it appears before that if they want this to happen, they better do something. But I think that's a clear message that this body ought to send to those, because else we have just consumed public funds and not advanced the actual progress toward a goal.
Okay, Heather.
I think I take a more positive view of what our seven cities and, you know, hopefully our county are doing. I know our city managers meet on a regular basis. We are policy setters, whether it's at this board or at our respective jurisdictions. And from my frequent communication with my city manager and even hearing from others, it's not as though we signed this compact and then nothing happened. We've been moving forward at varying levels on this, and I know just in my own jurisdiction, those top two priorities that have been, you know, the two of those 80s, we were moving forward on that. We're not sitting around saying, you know, hey, we're waiting for funding or we're waiting for someone to force us to do it, and I assume that other communities are doing the same. So while I appreciate that we don't want a study that just sits on the shelf, I don't think we should assume that cities aren't coming together and collaborating collaboratively figuring out where can we do these things. If we see that there's sticking points or something's not moving, then certainly we want to find out how to make that move forward. But I have a little bit more of a positive view on how we're working together right now.
Jimmy.
Thank you, Chair. I would echo that more positive approach, especially just coming from the City of Aurora Grande's perspective, where we made infill development on our Grand Avenue corridor a priority. We identified a vehicle to get there, general plan update. We funded it through ARPA funds, and many of the other cities are doing this kind of stuff. Grover Beach, I'm more focused on South County, being that it's my district, and have observed more closely the policies that the City of Grover Beach and Aurora Grande have been implementing. But it takes time. And I guess one of the things I would just highlight as, or why, to underscore the importance of future regional discussions and actions, would be to kind of inventory where each jurisdiction's at, and to, again, share, develop a mechanism for sharing tools. I know that in AG, for example, when it goes, say the community comes out and supports the general plan update process and says, let's upzone the East Grand Avenue corridor, maximizing infill development, you know, going higher, going up, not out, and there's a lot of support there. Well, to actually make it happen, utilizing tools like objective design standards, form-based codes, density bonuses, all that kind of stuff, if we have a way that we're sharing those tools so the city can proactively take those steps, I think we're going to make more progress. The other thing is that this board in the past, actually just one time since I've been on the board, and I'm on my fifth year, did we receive a report that looked at our progress regionally by jurisdiction on our RENA numbers. And I know it's being worked on because I've talked with James about that. But it's really important to do that check-in. We're in an eight-year cycle. We're a couple years in. How are we doing? And if we can continue to elevate that, because I don't think it's going to be a great status report. I hear the city of SLO is around 50%. Someone just mentioned that number. Andy might want to speak to that. That's, you know, maybe a good benchmark compared to where we are at the county. But to have that check-in, to continue that conversation, and to share on policy mechanisms would be great. And I think that this continuing this momentum is just a wonderful thing. Thanks.
Ed.
Yeah, I appreciate this discussion as well. I know our city, we've put about $3 million in supporting a couple of projects for low to mod income housing and senior housing, but we need a lot more. And I know funding is going to be a big part of it. One is infrastructure is going to be a big part of it. Where do we have land that's reasonably priced where we can build those kinds of projects? And it's going to be very difficult, and that's where I think we need to continue this. And I think as well, I know, I believe Heather touched on our city managers and CAO do meet regularly and consider housing impacts. And I think they're a key component of trying to work regionally. In some ways, staff has a lot more freedom to get together and try to work on solutions than we as a board do. But I think our leaders and our, you know, our executives certainly are a resource, and I think they've been working with you too on how to, in fact, I believe they're also including this City of Santa Maria city administrator as well.
If Carolyn, I can jump in.
Good to see you again, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Good to see you too. Carolyn, did you have something to add?
Yeah, if I could. I just wanted to step into, I wanted to echo what several of you have remarked on. Pete, I know, as part of those monthly meetings with the city managers and county administrative officer, as I mentioned, they were a key part of framing up how this plan should move forward back in December, knowing that it was at such a lightning speed, so you can only get so far. So Sarah's team created this incredible set of tools. There's a toolkit of policies that will be part of this process. There's a toolkit of funding opportunities specific to each project that's included as a priority for the region. And there's now this mapping tool that creates an ability to see each community in the context of the region and where it's efficient to build. And I say all of that because as you've each remarked on, there's now this set of tools and ways to move forward as a region. And I know last month we met with the city managers group to talk about how to pursue this summer's conversations with each council and board. And next week we're meeting with them again to start talking about what are those next steps. And again, it's just a matter of timing. With the grant funding, it's really rushing part of the process. So some of those next steps, implementation, need a bit of time to see what is each agency's role in this moving forward and what does it look like to make progress together. And I'll remark another thing that came out of the city managers group last month was making sure that we do give kudos to each community for all that has been done, because a lot has happened and there's yet, as you said, Director Gibson,
Bruce,
there's much more to do. I know, all the different roles and hats.
Easier.
But there's so much more to do. And I did want to echo that those conversations certainly are happening, but not to a point where they're ready to be gelled in front of any elected body yet. But we're hoping we hear some of that, too, from councils this
And if I could respond, I hail your work and the work of the city managers and the CAO. That's fantastic stuff, and a lot has been accomplished. I'd only observe that city managers and CAOs don't vote.
Thank you. So what I'm going to ask for right now is just a motion.
A public comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have any public comment speaking slips. If there's anyone that's changed their mind, please come forward. But otherwise, I'm going to ask for a motion for this board to, we commented, seek general support and
Well, I will move approval of staff's recommendation, if that's what you're asking
staff's
for.
Staff's recommendation just disappeared, but that's what, and then it's just a voice vote. Can I grab a second?
Second.
Perfect. Thanks, Carla. So all in favor?
Aye.
Any abstentions or opposition? Okay, great. Thank you so much. And thank you. Thank you, Sarah and Carolyn. We're going to move on to item number F5 now, and that's Tim.
It is me.
There you are, Tim.
President Arnold, members of the board, Tim Gillum, Slocog staff. We have a consultant, Sarah Sweet from DKS Consulting, who will be presenting the bulk of F5. Take it away, Sarah. If you're there.
Yep, I'm here, getting my Zoom situated here. Let me share my screen.
Welcome, Sarah, before you disappear off of her.
Yes, thank you, President Debbie Arnold and members of the board. Thank you so much for having me today. As Tim said, I'm Sarah Sweet with DKS Associates. And I, as well as many others, have worked on this project and put together this report for the region. And I'll just run you through it. And we'll get a couple more things situated. All right. So this will be a really high-level presentation, just so you're aware, but you should all have a copy of this presentation so you can dig into it in more detail. And most of this you've likely already seen, so it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be any surprises. A lot of it will be just a refresher. So I'll go fairly quickly in the interest of time. But right now, one of the reasons we wanted to come to you is because the public comment period is ending June 9th, this Friday. You have a couple more days to provide any public comment if you review the report online. We wanted to make sure to give you this report to give you a little time to do that. All right, so these are the project partners, and this is your project consultant team. And the project was funded by a Caltrans grant, a 21-22 grant. And this is a quick overview of the agenda. Now, all of the items up to the gap analysis you've likely already seen previously, should be pretty familiar with, so I will skim through those fairly quickly just as a refresher, and then I'll dig a little bit more deeply into the gap analysis and moving forward. All right, so here are the overall project objectives for this particular study. And the important thing I just wanted to note here is this project in particular was focused on interregional travel in unincorporated areas. So it did not focus on urban areas. Of course, there is need there as well, but this particular study did focus on that interregional travel. All right, first, the existing conditions. So this is just kind of your baseline, where things have started. And our assumptions for this were looking at 1 mile of highway interchanges in the study area and intersections and in the unincorporated areas. And the reason we did this is because this aligns with National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, which I'll talk a little bit more about, so I'll save that for later. But that is a big reason why we have those assumptions for this. So for San Luis Obispo, this is the total number of chargers in the county right now. So this is within cities as well, not just in unincorporated areas. So you can see you have a total of 535 public chargers. And now this is why there is a need to focus a little bit more on the unincorporated areas, because you can see that total drops quite a bit within those buffer areas down to 74. So there is a bit of a need to add more in those areas. And so to look at future needs, we did a few things. So we looked at the California Energy Commission's charger need forecast and looked at their projections. We also had focus groups, stakeholder input, lots of public input, as well as our own technical analysis to try to get a look into that crystal ball and see what might be needed in the future. So one note about the California Energy Commission charger projections is that they are in the process of updating their projections right now. The timing just didn't quite align with this study, so right now we're using the best data we have available, but we do recommend this will likely need to be updated in a little while once those projections are out. And they actually have a much better idea of driver behavior. There's just a lot more data out there. And in general, they expect level two chargers to decrease, the need for DC or the fast chargers to increase. And they do expect workplace and multifamily housing charger needs will increase as well. So just kind of keep that in mind for these projections. So right now, just in the unincorporated areas, the projections, as well as the other input and the buffers we've set up, there's a need for an additional 299, just under 300 chargers in those areas. And now for all public chargers in the study area, this is across the Central Coast, they expect a need of 27,000 chargers, and right now there's about 2,000, so that's quite a jump. There's going to need to be a lot of build out, but again, they do expect that number to actually go down a little bit for for level two at least. And now if you add in the multifamily and workplace charging, that does go up more, but one caveat here is the existing chargers. This isn't publicly available, so these are based on the California Energy Commission's projections of what is currently existing in multifamily workplace. So I mentioned stakeholder input. We saw a lot of common themes, infrastructure gaps, concerns about electrical grid capacity, equity, of course, permitting and regulation incentives. So we did address those in our recommendations, which you'll see in the report. We also got a lot of fantastic comments through Social Pinpoint, which is an online tool where you can collect input. And we received over 1,300 comments, so that was really fantastic. This is just kind of a quick breakdown of the kind of comments we got, lots of requests for charging stations in different areas. You can kind of look at this a little bit closer in the report. And now the gap analysis. So this is where the really fun, exciting part happens, right? At least for me. So looking at all the information I've talked to up until now, as well as the gaps in charging, putting in that stakeholder input, public comment, recommendations, all of that, we have this map here with the gaps. So where are chargers needed? Again, this is a lot to look at in a presentation. So it's just kind of give you a flavor of what you'll find more in the report. And with that, we came up with our top 20 locations, our recommended locations to prioritize sites. And five of those top 20 are in San Luis Obispo. And now, this is a very busy slide, but this is just an example of what is in the report, kind of looking at the more details within each county. So each county in the study area does have this more detailed breakdown that gets into exactly where the recommendations are, as well as maps. Potential funding sources. So this is part of our recommendations. We have a whole section on potential funding sources to help build these chargers out, because as you can see, there's a lot needed and they aren't inexpensive. So there's a lot of federal funding in there, which I'll talk a little bit more about. There's low carbon fuel standard. There's California Energy Commission grants, a lot of other regional and local grants as well. And we did include, as I mentioned, non-infrastructure recommendations. And we have quite a few in the report that address the public comment we received and other items. But one of the most important recommendations that I just wanted to highlight here today is the need for a mega region EV committee with objectives to help advance the installation of charging infrastructure in the region, and also to work towards seeking alternative fuel corridor status for Central Coast highways, because that is tied to a lot of federal funding, which is directly related to NEVI rankings. So NEVI is the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, total of $7.5 billion of federal funding, so a lot of money there. The federal government is really trying to work on building out this infrastructure. $5 billion of that will be awarded to states, which is tied to this ranking, which is why the alternative fuel corridor status is so important. And the project group is actually seeking certain recommendations for alternative fuel corridor status. So that's all based on a lot of the recommendations in this report. So already putting it into action. There is another $2.5 billion in what they call community charging grants. And that is another grant Tim will talk about in a moment here that the project partners are pursuing, again, based on a lot of recommendations in this report. So it's so exciting to see it already in action before it's even fully closed out and finished here. So that's great. So the next steps for this report, again, it is online, ready for or on with continuing review through June 9th. And so it's had a 58-day review. We've had a pretty good review review period on this. And the plan is for the SBCAG board to accept this formally in August on the 17th. So this is just a quick reminder of where you can find the report and provide that input and kind of dive into more detail. And with that, I will hand off to Tim to talk about the CFI grant.
Thank you, Sarah. Much appreciated. So out of the blue, a charging and fueling infrastructure grant opportunity came up. And let me show my... there's Sarah's got on. So this grant came out of nowhere. A NOFO notice of funding opportunity came up about a month and a half ago, and the three agencies working on the Central Coast Zero Emission Vehicle Strategy would be SBCAG, AMBAG, and SLOCOG. And we felt it would be an ideal time to put forth an application, a joint application from the three agencies. And not quite sure why Sarah's okay. So there's $2.5 billion available, of which $1.25 billion is for the corridor grant section of the CFI grant. There's a community portion of it, and then there's the corridor portion of it. We're submitting for the corridor grant in the amount of $20 million. And the applications, Sarah, can you forward? So we're looking for a $20 million ask for 20 locations for San Barbara County, San Luis County, Monterey, Santa Cruz, San Benito County. And San Luis County, we were looking at low-hanging fruit because this happened so quickly. We needed to get, you know, a letter of intent from the county. I had to get preliminary site designs quotes from energy company, and we're making good progress, but the applications are due next Tuesday, the 13th. Staff will be meeting with stakeholders and member agencies for cycle two, next round. Again, this is the first round of CFI grant funding, and it's possible we could get funded. And we're looking at about $1.2 million to $1.5 million for each of those locations. There is no local match required by any jurisdiction, and we're just plugging forward. With that, Sarah, if you want to go next slide, we can answer questions. Recommendations. Receive and comment on the draft Central Coast Zero Emission Vehicle Strategy. Again, public comments are due this Friday, June 9th. And TACs have received presentation and comments noted. And with that, Sarah and I can answer any questions.
Questions of the board. I will just say thank you very much, Tim, and that's very exciting news. Very exciting news.
Yeah, well, we're hoping we can get funded, and it's possible.
Thank you very much. And Sarah, thank you. If you're still hearing us, thank you very much for the presentation.
Thanks, Sarah.
Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have questions or comments, but we do have a public speaking request on that. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I always get curious when we get sudden news that billions of dollars are coming out of nowhere. I would appreciate knowing where is that nowhere? What taxpayers are paying it, and is it a specific tax relative to vehicle use, or are non-drivers and drivers being taxed alike for it? This electrification has become a major virtue signaling device. A book I would like to suggest and highly recommend, the author is Charles Eisenstein. The title is Climate, A New Story. He points out how using carbon dioxide as a single metric relative to our virtue or sin level on the globe's massively interlinked ecological crises tends to lead toward the net transfer of wealth toward governments and oligarchs and toward even further sacrifice of biodiversity and social equity. The 9-year-old miners in the Congo, the indigenous people in the Atacama Desert who are losing their oases to lithium extraction, there is an ecological cost to all this, and there is a huge financial cost to all this. Is this genuinely a helpful direction to be going relative to the interlinked social and ecological crises of our time? We are already witnessing drivers and non-drivers alike being taxed to help upper middle class drivers buy cars in the face of all kinds of preaching about the need for modal shift, do we mean it or not? And so I'm just wondering where this money out of nowhere is coming from, who it will benefit. Is it another tax on everyone to benefit drivers and to basically foment continued auto-centered transportation, or what is it? Electricity doesn't come from nowhere. Some of the sources, even in this immensely, immensely wet year, Hoover Dam, Lake Mead, which was at a record low level just recently, so far has come up 10 feet. I'm hoping they release more of Lake Powell into it, but again, where the electricity comes from is questionable. Don't get me started on the battles over Diablo, but essentially, we need to, well, I highly recommend the book, Climate, A New Story by Charles Eisenstein. It's a book written with heart as well as solid information. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, no lights on. Thank you very much for the presentation and the good news. And we will head to item G1. And Gus is here to, did you drive down this morning, Gus? Oh, I hope you didn't have congested traffic areas.
It's always a scenic drive, so it's always enjoyable to come down here, man.
You're still smiling, so I couldn't have been too bad.
Yes, thank you so much for the vote of confidence. I very much appreciate working with this body and look forward to a couple more productive years as well. So thank you. So lots going on in Sacramento, Madam President, board members. Gus, just for the record, Gus Corey, legislative advocate for SLOCOG. The legislature is currently mulling over the fiscal year 23-24 state budget and reviewing some legislation that the House of Origin deadline was last week. So now assembly bills are over in the Senate and vice versa. And so we have a couple action items for your consideration, but I just wanted to give a snapshot of kind of where we are and what we're working on for the balance of the remainder of session. So no secret, the state's general fund is a bit of a roller coaster. We literally play the stock market in order to do our state finances. We rely on personal income tax, corporate taxes, capital gains. And so when the economy does well, the state does well. When there's, you know, the boom bust cycle, we're in a bust cycle now. So we had a $97.5 billion surplus for this current fiscal year, which was a record, but now there's a $31.5 billion deficit projected for the upcoming fiscal year. And that, the $31.5 billion figure is a $9 billion increase over the January number of 22.5. And so that's a $257 billion swing since the inception of the pandemic, which is now over, but where you had a $53 billion deficit, a $76 billion surplus, $97 billion surplus, and now we're back down to a deficit. And so $42 billion in outstanding tax collection, that's due to all the flooding that was experienced throughout the state. And so the IRS and FTB said we'll give folks a break and not collect until October. But it does create some concerns only because the state does like to have hard numbers when they're trying to factor how to prioritize some of their budget decisions. The legislature does have to submit a budget to the governor by June 15th, which is the constitutional deadline. Governor Newsom has to sign the main budget bill by June 30th so that it goes into effect by July 1. But there will still be some outstanding issues that need some resolution. Thankfully, given the budget deficit, transportation is not really impacted, and that's because we're not reliant upon general fund revenues. We're still reliant upon the gas tax and things like the vehicle registration fee, which fund the Senate Bill 1 competitive programs that we've applied for. There is, that being said, because we had such a huge surplus last year, or for the remainder of this fiscal year, the legislature did propose some intent language. So it's conditional funding, $4 billion. It goes through the transit and intercity rail capital program, which you typically don't get transit funds for capital operations from that program. It's typically for the state transit assistance program, but they chose to go to through TRSEP. The problem, again, is that we do have a deficit, and so the governor is looking to claw back some of the money, although, again, it was conditional. So instead of a $2 billion allocation for fiscal year 23-24 and $2 billion for 24-25, he's proposing a billion for 23-24 and then $5 billion for 24-20, or sorry, I can't even talk this morning. See, that's what happens when you drive early. A $500 million allocation for 24-25 and for 25-26. The Senate and Assembly are pushing back, and they're saying, hey, look, there's a transit fiscal cliff. We need to be responsive and pour as many resources as we can, especially if we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So that's going to wind up being a big three negotiation between Governor Newsom, Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon, and Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins. And so we'll see how that resolves itself. The extension on fare box relief, this was a hot topic. We expect this to get done. So the fiscal relief where we weren't realizing the fare box collection that we needed to, so then MPOs would have to penalize the municipal operators as a result. There will be an extension of that relief for a few more years. I believe it's up to 5 years, if I'm not mistaken. I'm still waiting for the trailer bill language to come out. But that should account for any remnants of issues pertaining to the pandemic so that folks can continue to receive their TDA funding, and it won't impact any state of grid repair funds, transit assistance funds, any state funding that operators receive to maintain, if not expand, existing service. So our state legislative priorities, actually before I go to that, the California Transportation Commission, there are staff recommendations on some of our submittals. We should hear tomorrow on staff recommendations, and we're hoping for some positive news in that regard to fund 101 PISMO and hopefully maybe even State Route 46 at Union Road. And so fingers crossed on that one. We are working on a budget opportunity too with the Central Coast Caucus. So this was a newly formed caucus back in March. It's legislative members, bicameral, from Santa Cruz down to Ventura County. So there's 10 members, and they penned a letter. And Assembly Speaker-elect Robert Rivas was one of the signatories on that letter. Looking for some revenue for 46 and for 101. There's a $2.3 billion balance that the legislature has to spend down because the rainy day fund's at capacity. And so notwithstanding whatever happens with the CTC recommendations, that's kind of our plan B here, is to try to get either one of these projects fully funded through that effort. And I would expect that to occur at some point in August through a trailer bill. So we'll definitely keep you posted on that effort as well. So the state legislative priorities, we're always looking for every last nickel and dime that we can. We're a small county, as you heard previous presentation, you're all well aware. We're not a self-help, but we're heavily dependent upon state and federal resources. We were successful earlier this year in getting $14 million, actually Losan was, for the maintenance facility here in the county. It helps facilitate more frequent trips along the Central Coast. We're playing the game, right, that the state wants us to do. We've been incredibly aggressive with active transportation program applications. We've been successful there. We're trying for passenger rail service. We've spoken to the administration about having true passenger rail service, commuter rail service, intercity rail service along the Central Coast. And so that's another step in the right direction as far as fortifying those opportunities. Regional partnerships, we work very closely with the Central Coast Coalition and the Coast Rail Coordinating Council to try to advance some of our interests. They've been helpful with some of our Senate Bill 1 submissions. The transit funding reform is what I just referred to with respect to the state budget. Vehicle miles traveled, we'll talk about this one on the next slide. There's still some bills that are of consequence that you'll want to hear about and take action on. Passenger rail, the TRSIP award, as I mentioned. Modernization of the Brown Act. There were several bills introduced this session, and there's a couple for you to take action on. It's a little frustrating. The League of Cities had tried to sponsor legislation basically to allow for citizens advisory committees or just advisory committees to not be subject to the Brown Act. They meet virtually. These are people that aren't very well compensated. They're volunteering their time. And yet there was a tremendous amount of resistance from folks to proceed forward with that. I don't really understand why, but those bills became a two-year bill. So action items before you, and you'll see that there are strikeouts, and that's just because the legislative process does not sync up with our process as far as when bills are considered. But I'm going to review them anyway just to kind of give you context. Assembly Bill 6, this is going to be made into a two-year bill, so I got confirmation on that. What this bill would have done is it would have required the MPOs to further justify the methodology that's being used in putting together your sustainable communities strategy plan in coordination with the Air Resources Board. And instead of a collaborative process. It really would have created more of a top-down approach where ARB would get to dictate more to us as far as what targets we had to reach. So it undermines local control. The author relented and made it a two-year bill. And so this was an all-hands-on-deck effort with CalCOG, League of, and Suffolk County's Coalition as well, among others. Assembly Bill 7, it's been substantially amended. This bill has a lot of things that we're already doing. I mean, we're supporting equity, investments into rail, bike and pedestrian programs, zero emission freight, all these things to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There is one provision in the legislation that still gives us heartburn. The bill is trying to codify the governor's climate action plan for transportation infrastructure. This is putting an emphasis on funding multimodal options and deprioritizing highway capacity improvement projects. I won't say eliminate because they do make exceptions, but this would be much more intentional about not delivering highway projects that increase vehicle miles traveled, which in our case, we just don't have the same density as a Los Angeles or other, you know, regions of the state. The 101 is our main arterial in and out of here. We saw what happens when it floods, disaster response. The military uses the route among, you know, folks that want to access, you know, Cal Poly, et cetera. So we're asking the author to basically amend out that section because it says reduce VMT in urbanized areas, which is a pretty broad definition that could kill our ability to apply for state funding. So that's why we have an opposed unless amended position there. 463, just because it was on the matrix and it's in your board report. This one got held in the Assembly Appropriations Committee, but what it would have done is, given the recent storms, is Assemblymember Greg Hart, who represents Santa Barbara, when Montecito flooded, there was a real need to communicate, coordinate with their local transit provider there, Santa Barbara MTD, and they were not given priority for electricity service. And so that's a problem in trying to charge up their buses. They have some zero emission equipment that they want to fuel, but that got held up in Assembly Appropriations. And so we struck that one out. 557, also authored by Assembly Member Hart. This is one of the few Brown Act bills that's moving through the process, and it simply removes the sunset date of January 1, 2024. In order to allow you to convene if there's an emergency declaration issued for whatever purpose and to meet virtually as a body. So this is just an extension of AB 361. It just makes it permanent. So support on that one. 1335 is incredibly controversial. This one is frustrating in the sense that, well, I shouldn't say frustrating. It's vexing in the sense that there's just an awkward marriage of different planning documents, if you will, where you wearing your, you know, city or county hats, you know, how you engage in the RENA process, you have your housing element, you come up with certain metrics for calculating your population. That's just one component of what you do. SLOCOG has to coordinate with the Air Resources Board and factor in other things when they put together an SCS plan. What the bill is saying is that they want to use population figures generated by the Department of Finance. And what that's going to wind up doing is you're having to extrapolate basically 8 years of RENA over a 30-year planning document. And so your housing projection, I think in some instances, and I'll defer to Pete on this, but I think it doubles or triples what you have to produce for housing, which is absolutely nuts. And so if we don't meet a threshold, that results in us being disqualified from receiving certain state funds, you know, as a result. And so there's CalCOG does not have an official position on this, but MTC in the Bay Area does, SCAG does as well, so that should tell you something. So this bill is now in the second house, and it's being considered, so we're asking for an opposed position on this one. The next two bills on here, the governor had called a special session, and they're pretty much done with that. It was to try to ding the oil companies for the perceived price gouging during last fall. And so these bills were opportunistic in trying to eliminate or suspend the gas tax, which would have had a disastrous impact on our ability to fund our infrastructure. So we had an opposed position, but those bills are now dead. 537 is another Brown Act bill. What this bill does is it allows multi-jurisdictional entities. So think like, the Coast Rail Coordinating Council, for example, where you have that participation, or the Central Coast Coalition, if we had more elected participation there to allow you to meet in a virtual forum instead of having to meet in person. So these, again, this is only one of two bills on the Brown Act that are moving through the process. 617, I forgot to talk about the CEQA streamlining, which I'll get to in a second. 617 is Progressive Design Build. This is sponsored by the Self-Help Counties Coalition, but it helps out all counties. This just allows us, should we decide, if you're working with a contractor for design, you can also hire that same contractor for construction. They could help with construction. It's supposed to drive down costs and give some more familiarity, certainty to expediting project delivery. So we're recommending a support on that one. And then 825, it's sponsored by the Santa Barbara County Association of Governments. There was some legislation in a budget trailer bill passed last year, Senate Bill 156, that provided resources to implement first and last mile broadband service. But for whatever reason, on a technicality, MPOs are not eligible to apply, especially if you wear the same hat as the MPO and the RTPA. So it's just clarifying language to allow us to be eligible to try to accumulate some of those funds. And so we're recommending a support position there. And then I'm sorry, it's I know it feels like word vomit. I forgot the slide on the CEQA, but that's, it's really new. So Governor Newsom came out with a proposal week and a half ago. And there's an informational hearing on Monday in the Assembly. And what this is intended to do is CEQA streamlining on the whole. It's intended to shorten the administrative and judicial review process so that folks don't unnecessarily just delay a project, that you have to be a little bit more intentional about what your gripe is with a project, and then there has to be quicker amelioration of what the problem is. And then there's other things in there where it's reevaluating the endangered species list, because a lot of times under CEQA that also delays projects. So, you know, is, for example, I had this issue in Monterey County where the Santa Cruz long-toed salamander was on the endangered species list, but there hadn't been a sighting there in over like 4 years or something of that species, because they probably migrated to somewhere else along the stream. And but that held up a project there. And so it's reevaluating those species and then giving them full protection. And then there's maintaining NEPA delegation, which is federal environmental clearance for the Department of Transportation, particularly when you're trying to deliver a transit project, rail as well. So this helps in coordination with the Federal Rail Administration, et cetera. So that's kind of a snapshot of the CEQA thing. Some folks are a little bit leery. They think that it's an easing. The governor would argue that we're just trying to expedite. We're not compromising the integrity of CEQA. We're just trying to expedite, you know, it's the blessing of a project, et cetera, so that we could deliver these things, accelerate our response to climate change. And so, Madam President, I know I said a lot, but these are the action items before you, is basically to support four bills, oppose one, and then the oppose unless amended on two. And just to go back, the oppose unless amended, or I take that back, and I'm sorry, Tim, for this. Number one is no longer relevant, so it's really just an oppose unless amended on AB7.
Questions for Gus over here? Sorry, Ed?
Yeah, just on the fare box recovery ratio, I think you touched on that. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, the fix, or the problem?
Well, the problem, obvious, is that we're not meeting our recovery ratios. We've had a delay in requiring it, but is that going to be resolved by legislation, or is it still in the administration?
Yeah, yes. So it'll manifest itself into a budget trailer bill. So we're still waiting for a vehicle to be identified. I'm not sure which one. That should come out relatively soon, though, because, again, they have to vote on this next week, and there's a 72-hour print rule. So it could come out today or tomorrow. I just have to double check. But yes, it's not just for TDA funds. It'll be for all state funds. So STA, State of Good Repair funding that we receive, that RTA receives, So for Atascadero, for among other people.
Just a minor correction. Vince Fong, I think, is still a Republican. You had him down as a Democrat.
I did.
On your staff report.
Oh, shoot. There's two Fongs, so...
Oh, there's two Fongs. I didn't realize that. Democrat Fong then.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize there were two Fongs. All right. My mistake. Also, I want to thank you for putting together that, I call it Dog and Pony Show, to support our local transportation efforts, certainly in Pismo Beach. And you had all the bright people there, and Senator John Laird was very supportive of what we're trying to do. I guess also, I believe Rivas takes over speaker in July. Is that when he starts or when?
Technically, it's June 30th.
Okay. That should help, too. So
we hope so.
Thank you very much.
Of course.
Andy, you had some? No? Other questions? Jimmy?
Just one comment. Our disadvantaged community status, I think, has been put on your radar just in terms of the number of definitions that get utilized to determine which parts of our Slo County community are, in fact, considered a disadvantaged community status. I've seen maps at the federal level that don't show areas that should be, for example, community of Oceano, but do show parts of San Luis Obispo. At the California state level, the Cal OES maps completely omit certain areas in our community. So anything you can continue to do, I know we're coordinating with our federal legislative advocate as well, but it's becoming an issue in terms of our eligibility for grants. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Guess you must have been referring to Senate Bill 670, Allen, vehicle miles traveled. You're asking us, or you're recommending a watch on that?
No, on AB7, there's a provision, subdivision O, that references vehicle miles traveled in urban.
What does it say?
It says that to reduce vehicle miles traveled in particularly in urbanized areas.
But it's mostly addressing urbanized areas.
Yes.
Okay, then.
And they don't have defined. They don't have urbanized area defined.
But still, a county like ours with so much agricultural work, think it will affect us if it passes?
Possibly. I think we might get dinged. And so it's always the devil's in the details. And it's given somebody a hook to say, sorry, you're inducing additional vehicle miles traveled, which is unavoidable given just our composition.
Okay, thank you. We have one request to speak. Eric.
Greening, I'd like to thank Gus for his excellent comprehensive work and for being here all morning in three dimensions in real time. It's always wonderful to have him around. He's able to leave that den of iniquity up there now and then and hang out with real people. Of course, those are real people, too. We just have to keep them real. Speaking as a member of several advisory committees on transportation and water, even though it is a hassle, and I, as a non-driver, I have a particular hassle getting places, et cetera, I would be part of any pushback against any attempt to evade the Brown Act on the part of our advisory committees. We are doing the people's business. We should do it transparently and accessible to the people and accessible to the opinions of the people. Obviously, there's a difference with an ad hoc group that maybe works on a particular thing for 6 months and then comes back to the main body, and the main body considers it before passing on its recommendations. I wouldn't extend the Brown Act to all those levels, but any time an actual action is going to be taken by a whole advisory body, I do believe that the Brown Act is as warranted there as it is any place else. And on the CEQA issues, my relief is that Newsom's push was not accomplished through the very, very inappropriate medium of budget trailer bills, and that now they're actually starting through a more orderly hearing process. Is that, I presume that's now the way it's going and not another attempt to sort of push it through this process that has no hearings and no real opportunity to consider the nuances, amend as needed, et cetera. And obviously, I'm always strong on the distinction between streamlining versus weakening, and so I'm going to be watching the language like a hawk. I don't yet know what I will or won't support, but if this is kind of a new start with these things, I continue to uphold CEQA as actually, in the long run, often a saver of money and trouble to the extent that it provides for better projects with fewer negative impacts and a greater balance of positive and negative. And that's its intention. It can be misused as just about any law can be misused, but it's critical to our quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you. And Gus, thank you for making your way here. Let's see. We have staff recommendations then to support. You can see the staff recommendations.
Move support.
Thank you, Andy.
Second.
Perfect. Let's see. This is a...
Who moved?
I did. The, as
this is just a voice vote, right? Ada.
Roll call. Who's roll second? Call.
Says
Vice President Peace?
Yes.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
Yes.
Board Member Paulding?
Yes.
Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Waggy?
Yes.
Board Member Wexham?
Yes.
President Arnold?
Yes.
The motion carried.
Perfect. Thank you, guys. So now you have our best wishes to go back to Sacramento and defend us. Thank you. Okay, we'll finish up our meeting here with board member comments, and if anyone has a report to leave with the rest of us, how about then we go ahead and adjourn, and August 2nd will be our next meeting. Thank you, everyone.
I have...
Good stuff.